We are Brightside.
Talked about like how OBS and is it OBS or OSB? I get
OBS, yeah.
OSB is the wood.
OSB is the oriented strand board, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. OBS,
whatever, broadcasting software,
yeah,
open
exactly.
Broadcasting
it's
software.
It's like, I was talking with my brother-in-law about like how I'm doing the theater and I'm doing all the OSB.
Yes.
in the theater, right? And I kept saying OBS. He goes, it's not OSB. He goes, I know what you're talking about. He goes, but you sound like an idiot. And I was like, oh yeah, but here's the thing. I have OBS is a thing.
He's like, it doesn't help that there used to be the one side bad plywood, right?
Yeah.
That was also OSB. So that's changed now.
Yeah. So anyways, getting back to that, it's like when it's just the audio only like this, I actually get two tracks using the Rodecaster.
Right.
It's when I have multiple guests, I still only get two tracks.
Yeah.
Right. But this would allow me to have a track for everybody. So if I have to level match everybody, it makes it easier and things have gotten substantially easier.
By the way, I mean, I'm assuming it doesn't particularly matter my levels at this moment.
Nope.
Because you can, there's only the two of us, so you can level match if needed.
Yep. Right, so. Exactly. So,
right.
So much simpler than back in, like, what, 5 years ago?
It was like, it should get that way. That's the way technology should progress.
But, isn't that nice?
It doesn't always.
No. Yeah. So it's funny. That's a fun one right there. I had Chris Deering on a while ago and we were talking about, HDMI.
Okay.
And you and I have had this conversation too, is that I've always just thought like, HDMI, I'm like, oh man, it's just so much easier than what it was back. You know, you had coax,
it is one
RCA.
Cable. We have to give it that.
Yeah. But then when Chris was explaining it to me, I was like, I started to hate HDMI because he's like, there are better options. I just don't want to use them.
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, in several ways. I mean, just physically, we could have a better connector, one that, you know, isn't just friction fit and isn't prone to, you know, loosening just due to gravity over time.
And, yeah.
With a connector that's once it's slightly bent out of shape, you're pretty much hosed.
Yeah.
then the fragility of the 19 tiny little pairs of wires and pins on the ends of those connectors. So yeah, physically, it could be an improvement. I mean, signal wise, you know, I mean, I guess what people are going to point to, display link, right? You could say,
the
okay,
handshake.
That's the, yeah, well, I mean, on the handshake side of it and just on the signaling side of it, people will point to display link, you know, it's capable of higher bandwidth than HDMI is and, you know, has a little bit more of a clear path going forward. HDMI is going to need some further redesigns if we're going to go past 48 gigabits per second. You know, using, the display stream compression, right? DSC. You know, having to insert that to fit more data down the same amount of bandwidth and DisplayPort is using that too. But, on the other hand, like DisplayPort cables, we're not seeing 50-foot, 100-foot DisplayPort cables. There's sort of a reason why DisplayPort is able to handle that greater bandwidth, which is that it really is a computer. Like it's for computers and the chances that your computer is going to be 100 feet away from your monitor is a little less likely than we have in home theater scenarios. So yeah, I mean, I give HDMI some credit because they've managed through, it's not just the engineering side of it, right? It's getting the entire industry, the entire consumer electronics and, for that matter, computer industries, because it's not as though computers don't have HDMI inputs and computer monitors don't have HDMI inputs. They do. So getting multiple industries with a tremendous number of brands who all have patents and who all want desperately want their own proprietary features that they can then market as being exclusive to their brand and only working between, you know, similarly branded products. Like, having all of those motivations going on in the background, and then managing to put out some kind of connector that is almost universally adopted across, I have to give him some credit for that. So
yeah.
But what was Chris Deering saying, you know, as far as, you know, what could be improved so much over HDMI?
Well, I don't want to, like, I'm not very good at regurgitating stuff like you are, like whether you read it or heard it, but basically my interpretation was, it was really kind of like there was better technology at the time, but this just won out. It's kind of like, I mean, you know, VHS beta was better, but VHS won out, right? And then same with Blu-ray and HD DVD. HD DVD.
Even more debatable.
Well, it's debatable, but Blu-ray got there, but at the time when it first released, HD DVD was the better scenario. It played
it
better.
It was the more consistent at launch. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it didn't mean that Blu-ray wasn't going to get there. But if you were voting on performance at the time, Blu-ray was losing left and right.
They didn't have their audio sorted out when they started releasing discs. So, and falling back on multi-channel uncompressed PCM because they had a little bit more storage space. So that was an interesting way to move forward.
But basically what Chris was saying was, like, there was a better alternative at the time.
Okay.
That alternative is still there. I don't remember which one it was, but it's like, he goes, it couldn't do this and this. And like, and he's an expert in this stuff. So I'm just like,
maybe like digital SDI or something like that.
And it was
like,
whatever it was, but I was like, why don't we do that then? He goes, 'cause nobody wants to. But
at this point, trying to switch to something else, that would be a much more of a challenge than just being able to demonstrate that it's technically superior in some relatively small way, honestly, at this point.
But to get even like you said, I give HDMI credit. It's like the only time HDMI is an issue is when you try to get the most you can possibly get out of it.
Sure.
For 99% of the population, the plug and play simplicity is exactly what it's supposed to do. It's our listeners, our fan base, our hobby is the one that's pushing the limits of this, going, this sucks.
Yeah. I mean, clearly the most predictable problem you're going to have is attempting to, connect more than one thing with HDMI, like more than one display, even if they're not both on at the same time, or more than one sound system, you know, trying to get that distributed. So I mean, coming back to the whole, everything has to be lowest common denominator, honestly, to get it to work. And even then, you know, if you have lowest common denominator, if you're going to have two displays both connected, at the same time, and then also try to make CEC work, it's going to quickly turn into, let's just try and attempt to turn most of these features off before we even begin. So that's the most challenge. But I mean, I would, on the other hand, I would say some pretty simple setups, as in a single TV, a single external source, and a sound bar. Because that's being sold to very much regular people who are just going into a big box electronics store.
Right.
That's not something yes, adding even just a sound bar to many people's systems is more than what a lot of people will do, but that's, I don't consider that complicated in the same way as a, you know, entire bespoke home theater type of setup. And I think it's pretty common. And even there, just with those three things, that should be very easy to connect together with HDMI, which is very much the promise of it. Even there, we run into issues where, it isn't working as plug and play as we would hope. So
it won't plug and cooperate. It'll still play, but you might not have the simplicity of a single remote, or you might not have the simple, you know what I mean?
Where, or it's, you'll still get the black screens in between whenever you try to switch something. And then, of course, heaven help you if you add a cable box to your system, because for whatever reason.
You're adding complications, Rob. You're adding more links.
But again, like I don't think it's crazy that someone's going to use the apps that are built into the smart TV they just bought, output the sound to a sound bar, and then plug in a cable box. Like that's, a little bit more complicated than the absolute bare bones, but that's still pretty, I can see a lot of people, completely normal non-home theater people wanting to do that level of complexity. Yeah.
But it is, it's funny. I had a comment yesterday, my, Takeover Tuesday about, better quality. I thought of you too when I was reading it. Better quality when you use the app directly in the television. And I think they were using, might have been a Sony, or in the, in the email, somebody said their cousin or their brother, Sony, was great. Mm-hmm. I think he had a LG, and it was basically he compared it to an Nvidia Shield. He was compared, like watching content. I think he was saying The Mandalorian, if I remember right. Mandalorian season 3 or something like that. And he went back and forth, and he's like, it through the television, the app in the smart television, he goes, it was clear, like it was crisper, it was nicer. He goes, the Nvidia Shield. And then his brother or cousin found the same thing. And then I had made the comment that, you add links, you add complications, and there's a chance, you know, and it's a simpler, you know, keep it simple, stupid type of thing. And it's like, it's always the easiest way. And it's like, and when, and we tend to, in this hobby, we tend to upgrade when sometimes there isn't an upgrade needed. Right.
And it's definitely.
It's like, I didn't see a problem, but I just tried this and it's now this is worse.
If we relied on actually noticing a problem before ever doing it.
Well, that's how I've always done it. And it's like, if I see something, I'm like, how do I solve that? And there are enough problems in home theater to solve in your systems that you don't need to invent them. You don't need to be like, oh, somebody said this is a good idea, so I'm doing it. If you don't see a problem, don't do that. You know what I mean? So, because you're gonna, as you progress through home theater, you're gonna find them. And it's like,
oh yes.
And that's the best part, is when you find them, then you solve them. That's great. When you create problems. Yeah,
if that's your personality, that you enjoy the, you get the dopamine hit from solving a problem, which is many of us, of course. Yeah.
Who doesn't? I get the dopamine part, but they don't get any satisfaction out of solving something. It's like, be like,
it seems. Yeah. Really? I've certainly come across people who would just rather avoid it entirely.
Well,
right.
But the
satisfaction of solving it doesn't outweigh the bad feeling of having to put the effort in the first place.
Oh, yeah. So yeah. Okay. I see. I thought you meant you're done and you go, well, that didn't even make me feel better.
I suppose it'd be a little unusual to have no sense of satisfaction, but I wanted to go back a little bit to the example that you gave. That's my perpetual evergreen favorite topic to discuss, like on AV Rant, because it's not something that's ever going to go away, is the misattribution, right? Or multiple variable scenario. But believing, like, it's so easy to say, if I swap one component for another similar component, and I notice a difference, then can't I just attribute the difference that I noticed to having switched one component for a similar component? That intuitively seems like a single variable, right?
Right.
It seems like I changed one thing in my system. I changed the device I use to stream my content from the built-in apps of my television to an external streaming box, or vice versa. That's one variable, intuitively. But it isn't. Like, we know it isn't one variable that just changed, because do you happen to, like most TVs, when you go to one of your HDMI inputs and then you switch to the built-in apps of the TV itself, they don't necessarily use the same picture settings. You can manually get them there, but by default, they'll sometimes change. clear example, if you're streaming Netflix or now Amazon Prime, they have their own Netflix calibrated mode. Amazon Prime calibrated mode is newly being introduced. You know, Sony talked about that for their new 2024 TVs, but like, those things only happen on the built-in versions of right. those apps, the built-in TV version. It'll by default go to the Netflix calibrated mode if your television comes with that. You might not necessarily know that, you know, right. like that's not something I'm going to expect anybody who walked into a Best Buy to be aware even exists, let alone know that they should check their picture settings versus what they just set their HDMI one input to, you know, so like that's a variable that had nothing to do with the hardware or had something to do with the hardware device, but like not you thinking that's the variable I changed. It's an unseen variable, something you didn't realize what's happening. There's what's the frame rate that's going on, right? Almost all of the built-in streaming apps on the televisions, they're doing it at 60 hertz. That's the signal that they're using. And then maybe or maybe not applying inverse 3.2, inverse telecine. Some of them do, some of them don't. Some of them, when they do it, there's no way to turn off that they add a little bit of motion smoothing to it, or you can change how much motion smoothing they add to it, and it's not the same amount that gets applied to your external HDMI input. Like, an unknown variable that could easily make you say, I see a difference.
Right.
I'm not just imagining it. because now my panel is refreshing at 120 and its backlight is strobing at 240. I noticed that a moving image looks clearer, but all I did was change from the built-in app to the external device, right? Right. So, and I blame the external device for not looking as good. You know, but unbeknownst to you, there were these other variables that were changing in the background. And then, yeah, if you're just talking to somebody who's excited, because they said, you know, I've been using a Amazon Fire TV stick for the past 2 years and I bought a new TV and I gave its built-in apps a go. And you know what? Those built-in apps, it looks better. It looks better on the built-in apps. And it's got to be because it's newer. My Fire TV stick is 2 years old. That's got to be it, right? And it's like, everything that I just said for the past 7 minutes, do you really want to, like, does anybody right. besides you and I want to hear that?
Right.
You
know,
like, well, or are their eyes going to roll to the back of their head yep. and then they're going to walk away and go, it's because it's newer. And that's the yeah. end of the,
well, not you know, that the thought process. It's newer. It's like, and that's kind of basically, I said, ironically for me, mm-hmm. I said it shorter. I said, like, he was using an NVIDIA Shield, right? And that's mm-hmm. supposed to be that and Apple TV, I think, are the
sure.
arguably front runners of you can get yeah. the most out of your system, right? Mm-hmm. So I said it doesn't just because what's in your if you prefer on the television what you're seeing, go with yeah. that. Why would you if you
yeah, yes.
But yeah. if I'm sure, and I said in the show, I'm sure you could probably set the NVIDIA Shield to duplicate right. that. You just yeah. got to know what the settings are, what the,
yes.
what is that doing to do that? And it's, and then I got, I think it was, PK in India was say, he mm-hmm. commented on Twitter after, mm-hmm. after the show yesterday. And he had mentioned, he's like, just because people tell you something is better doesn't mean it always is. Trust your eyes
that
or something.
Too.
And it's true. yes. But, yes. but at the same time, it's like, and this is where I think, and Jim, my calibrator buddy, many, many years ago, like probably mm-hmm. 20 years ago, told me, get off the internet because all it's doing is making you want to get stuff you don't even need. Right. And that's where it's like, and I was like, oh, okay. And I kind of was already there. And that's what was, that's why we had sure, such yeah. a great relationship.
Is that's because, a balancing act to some extent. Sure. Yeah.
well, yeah. And that, like I said earlier, if you see a problem, solve a problem. Don't, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. if you see a device, don't just buy it because you think it's better. so it's, that's the issue. But yes, it's like, and all of these things, and that's the part that where we get into, and you and I have talked with our people many times, like, mm-hmm. do I get a calibration? Do I not get a calibration? Do mm-hmm. I do this? Do I do that? And it's like, the more intricate you get, the more complicated things yeah. get, but you get closer to what is supposed to be actually going on the display. whereas sure. there's a case to be made, which is correct. right? Like if Apple TV is telling you this is how you should watch this, and then you go to your NVIDIA Shield and go, well, we shut everything off because this is the way it's supposed to, you know, like we don't want that motion smoothing. We don't want all that, but it doesn't look as good to me. But Apple TV is telling you that's exactly how they want it displayed. Okay.
Well, yeah, and we've got, you know, we're dealing with lossy compression in both of them, including in the video, right? Because we're compressing it more. So, I mean, look, you know, I hear people refer to, you know, Ultra HD Blu-ray discs or Kaleidoscape, sometimes incorrectly referred to as lossless on the video side as well.
Right.
They're lossless on the audio side, although there's exceptions to that too, right?
It can be.
Sure. But I mean, it truly is not. It absolutely is not. There is unequivocally no question that the video on anything we have at home is lossy video compression. There is data that has been thrown away from, like if you just had literal uncompressed, every single bit is or every single pixel is 30 bits per subpixel times 3 for each pixel times every single pixel, right? We're into, you know, terabytes, petabytes of information for a single movie. And so clearly, you know, cramming all of that down into 66 gigabytes is a massive amount of lossy, video data compression. And then, you know, what we're getting on any streaming version of that
is
an order of magnitude compressed further than that. So yeah, it's absolutely not lossy on, lossless on the video side ever what we're seeing. And there's a variable there. I mean, I kind of wanted to make a joke again, going back to the built-in apps, because if he thought that what he was getting through the built-in Sony apps, you know, versus plugging in an NVIDIA Shield or whatever, you know, wait till until his mind gets blown when he goes out and gets a USB Ethernet adapter and hardwires an Ethernet connection to a USB Ethernet adapter that gets plugged in the TV, because the Ethernet ports and the Wi-Fi on most smart televisions is limited to 100 megabits per second. It's not even gigabit Ethernet or Wi-Fi that's built into most smart TVs, but you can get gigabit Ethernet going into your TV if you get a USB adapter. So, I mean, that's going to blow your mind. You know, some people are going to claim that, right? You know, seeing they go to the speed test app built into their TV, and they're like, holy crap, I can get so much pulling down. Except how often is more than 100 megabits per second coming in through any streaming service?
Exactly. Right?
But that still gets into people's heads that that's what's going on. But yeah, I mean, everything that you're talking about, it is sort of the where I've landed attitude wise for the time being, feeling that where we are now with the products that essentially anybody could go out to, again, just any big box store, purchase without knowing really much of anything, you know, and maybe have a modicum of help setting it up or something like that. Like, of course, you know, folks listening to your podcast, folks listening to my podcast who really want to get into the very fine nitty gritty details are going to say, well, the chances of completely optimizing, getting every last drop of potential performance out of what you bought, probably not going to get that if you just go to a Best Buy. Now probably can't even have a Geek Squad member sign it up because they all got fired, you know, hook it up for you. But like, you know, have a little bit of help. Your cousin who knows a little bit about TVs comes over and hooks it up for you and, you know, at least gets your TV out of Vivid Mode. You know, that you're not wringing every last drop of performance out of that setup. But then I've landed completely on the side of, but honestly, like really honestly, how bad is it? You know, because what we're able to get now with out of the box settings, you usually have to make one settings change somewhere, but like you don't have to dig into the sliders, right? It's literally you change from this picture mode to this picture mode. You change your sound bar from this listening mode to this listening mode. You're not doing any of the finer adjustments. You leave it at that. And it's like you're getting a remarkably pretty darn good experience at that point. One that outside of a side-by-side comparison in their own room, it would be, I would claim, impossible to reliably detect the difference. You know, if you had to see their system and then drive from their house to your house and look at the other system and then drive back to make the comparison, I would argue that if you didn't know if you were being teleported, you know, you, that you, you wouldn't reliably be able to tell those things apart in a, like a, an ABX comparison. And then if you do have that side by side comparison, they're not even that far apart. You know?
It depends on the systems. That's sort of where I am now. It depends on the system.
Yeah. Of course there's degrees, but it's like what I'm getting at is there was a time. There was a time where you went to a Best Buy, you bought a rear projection CRT TV. We didn't have sound bars at that time. So you bought a Kenwood receiver and you, if you were lucky, you got some Polk or JBL speakers because those were probably the only two actual audio brands that you would find in a big box store at the time, you know, otherwise you
would. Oh, they have B&W. I know Best Buy Circuit, did Circuit
maybe
City.
Going even back, Best I mean, going Buy back
in the
early
then. 2000s, early yeah. 2000s, they had B&W. They had,
but those were,
Definitive.
Those at that time were more expensive. They were definitely more expensive, you know, so maybe you ended up with some, maybe you were really lucky and you got right there when Athena was around, you know, really quite, inexpensive, but really well designed speakers. It's something like that. But you know, you bring all of that home, maybe you hook it up mostly correctly because most people aren't going to thoroughly read the manual and all that, and it's like, and you don't touch any settings, and you view that experience back then at that time when I was certainly getting into home theater at around that, I'm talking, you know, end of the 90s, beginning of the 2000s, you know, that sort of time frame. I actually know your history personally, you know, DJ, exactly where you were in your home theater journey at that time. But like, you know, both of us were, I mean, mainly because home theater itself was sort of a burgeoning thing at that time. So it's not like you could have been way, way earlier, you know, 80s. In terms of just, yeah. But I mean, like getting like Dolby Digital, right? Getting like surround sound at home. It wasn't like 80s. Way before the 90s. Was it the 80s? Yeah, Dolby Digital?
Yeah. Dolby Surround was in the 80s. ProLogic.
Surround,
came,
yeah.
Yeah, Dolby Surround was in the 80s. Yeah. ProLogic came out in the late 80s. Okay. And then Dolby Digital actually came after AC3. AC3 came out on Laserdisc, and that was in the early 90s. And that was your first digital, like, five-channel discrete.
But I would venture that as far as like mass market, most people weren't dealing with Dolby Digital at home until DVDs.
Right? Correct. I mean, that's where, DVDs and actually that's where Dolby AC
popularized it.
Dolby AC3 got relabeled as Dolby Digital for DVD because it was Audio Codec 3 because was that's where you got AC3 because it was surround, ProLogic, and AC3, which in, digital got version, renamed to Dolby discrete. Digital. Right. But that was your first chance at five discrete channels.
Yeah, that's right.
And that was in the early 90s.
At home.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, going back to my point, it was just like at that time, you know, late 90s into the early 2000s, there was, I would argue, a bigger gap between what your average consumer who's just buying a system for themselves at Best Buy and leaving it at the default settings, what they would have ended up with compared to a system at that very same time that was tweaked and properly calibrated and completely correctly set up, that the gap between those two things was larger and much more noticeable than the gap today, just using default settings with a beautiful flat panel that doesn't cost an arm and a leg whatsoever at a remarkably large size these days.
Right.
You know, you bring that home, you connect it to a half decent sound bar, you don't change any of the default settings except getting the TV out of Vivid mode, which even that manufacturers are starting to change now. And like the gap between that and a fully calibrated system, I would argue is now smaller.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, like, because of that, because of where we are now and the level of quality that's being achieved with a minimum of effort and a minimum of required study and knowledge before making those purchases. 'Cause I'm always on the side of more than just bang for buck and more than just trying not to overspend other people's money. You know, if somebody's asking for my advice, I don't want them to overspend. I want them to spend, you know, not necessarily the absolute minimum, because I think there are times where spending a little bit more money gets you worthwhile improvements in performance. But you know, I want that excellent bang for a buck. But more than that is just the practical side of how much time and effort do I actually want, expect someone to put into their home theater system to get really satisfactory results. And I mean, for the people who are actively engaged, the many members of our listening audiences for our podcasts who this is their hobby, this is what they like to spend their time doing, and they are going to go to the extreme and go past the point where they know they're spending more time and effort than they're really getting a return on. But that's fine, because part of the return they're getting is just the enjoyment of doing the process.
Yeah.
But for many people, they're on the other side of that value proposition. It is not going to give them a good return on time and effort investment. They're not going to get a big enough benefit coming back to them in any form.
Right.
For me to expect them to go to the extreme levels that many people that we talk to are willing to go to. And I'm more comfortable with that than ever today, because the difference is shrinking in terms of how noticeably different it's actually going to be. If they put in, you know, a solid 48 hours of effort, where they end up is not going to be so far away from where they began anymore.
Well, yeah. But if you're just trying to put in 48 hours of effort, yeah, you're right. You're
That's
not
a lot
gonna,
of time.
Right. But if you, and this is where it's like, where I notice the difference is if you're putting in, now to your point, it's like, oh, I just decided to do this and I want a new home theater. I'm new to the hobby. And it's like, what? And they write into AV Rand's like, what can I do? And you guys do a great job of giving you that. Okay, here's your 48 hours of effort. But that doesn't mean that at the end of that 48 hours of effort, it's going to be equal to what the systems like what I have or what people have, because it's like, I don't have 48 hours of effort. I have 30 years of effort.
Right.
And here's the thing. It's not the effort. It's the ability to see the difference. You know what I mean?
Like, I suppose
people would know, like people, like they would see, you go to see that new home theater and you could give them like, they let them set it up similar to what I have here, right? And you go in and you be like, okay, that's great. And be like, how come this one here just seems crisper, or this one seems this, or this one seems that?
I don't know. I argue with that a little bit. Like when we're not talking about, you know, home theater aficionados, right? Mm-hmm. When we're not talking about,
what
people,
do you mean?
You're like, well, you've got the people who are building bespoke, dedicated home theaters, and then they visit someone else's home theater, and that crowd, our crowd, our people, you know, that crowd might notice small video image quality differences, small audio quality differences. But I would argue that way more people, why do we put 9 and 12 seats into our theaters? It's not just for home theater aficionados only.
Right.
It's for when we have our regular friends who might not be into home theater at all. We have those extra seats in our theater so that they can come in and enjoy a movie or a game or whatever it is. And I would argue that they do not notice or care at all about the small video and audio quality differences. What they notice is the decor. They notice the nice seats.
Well, that's
right. Yeah.
And that's like, what I was like, saying. But, like, if they did the exact same setup, right? Same idea. Like, I got the seats. I got that. They had a budget and they're like, look, this is a birthday gift, or my scratch ticket hit, and this is what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And that's what I was going to say, Rob, is like, when you're so new to it, you could have the exact same setup. Listeners would go in and go, oh, I see the difference here, right? Mm-hmm. We would notice the difference. The new guy wouldn't. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't see the difference.
So we're in agreement.
That's what I'm saying. And it takes time to learn that. And then that new guy would be sitting there, and over time, he would watch his over and over, right? And a year later, after not having been in my theater for a year, he'd come in and now he'd be like, wait a minute, this is slightly different here because now his eyes have learned and he's learning things. You see what I'm saying? It's like, because he set it up.
I think that's a subset of a subset, but okay.
But that's our audience. That's our crowd. And it's like, we have all sorts of people. We have people that have been doing this as long as I have. And we have people that have been doing it for like 5 years. So.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And that, that's the internet. And everybody like thinks that like all of this, it's like your perception is your reality. So what you see is what you, and that's why like on the internet, like you'll see people, oh, there's no difference between streaming and physical. Well, not on your setup. Yeah.
But, no, I think you've hit exactly on what has been sort of a little bit of an emotional downer for me when it comes to chatting about home theater lately, because I feel quite differently from what you described. I agree with the scenario that you've laid out. I'm right with you there, and I obviously know exactly the type of people that you're talking about, right? They get a very similar room to yours with a very similar decor and those similar comfort, and it's acoustically treated and all of those things.
Yeah.
And then, they're over the moon because they got an Epson 5050 UB, right? And neither of us is going to argue that they made a bad choice in getting that projector.
Right.
You know, they get that and, you know, they get a AV receiver and it's powering a 5.2.4 setup. And then, like you say, they spend the 1-2 years getting very used to their system. And then they come to your system that's got some upgrades from what they have. And it's not that they feel that they wasted their money, but they're like, okay, DJ's got something that's even a step above that, right? I get that 100%. But on the, I am more and more leaning to the other side, which is A, I think there's a ton of people that genuinely, wouldn't notice the difference.
Oh, absolutely. Like,
at all. Or, 99%
of the population.
Right. Or any difference that they do notice, they're going to be like, wait a second, DJ, how much did your projector cost?
Correct.
Versus my Epson 5050 UB.
What's your system cost?
How much did your speakers cost? Right. Or how much did your, you know, receiver, you know, and then they're going to do a very quick and easy math in their head and go, okay, wait a second. Is your projected image 3 or 4 times better because it was 3 or 4 times more expensive? And they're going to quickly say, you know what? Whatever difference I see, I'm not worried about it because I saved that much money. But I'm more and more leaning to the side of, I guess what it comes down to is I'm not a fan of stratification in virtually any part of life. I don't like it when people start getting farther apart. Emotionally makes me feel less good when people start getting farther apart from each other. And what's been a little bit of a bummer for me personally, and this is very much, okay, I'm noticing these things being said online, and it's not necessarily, the truth at large, but it's what Rob happens to be noticing. So it's my perception as well, but I feel, I can't objectively prove in a way, but I feel like there is becoming a greater separation, in terms of people who are really into home theater. It's the same 100,000 people who are subscribed to every home theater YouTube channel and are subscribed to every home theater podcast. It's the exact same 100,000 people out of the 8 billion people in the world.
Yeah.
And that crowd is like, well, intentionally or not, moving ourselves, I'll include myself in the group, moving ourselves farther and farther downstream, more niche, more nitty gritty, and getting farther away from the starting point, even as I would argue objectively, the starting point is getting closer to virtually ideal performance I'm honestly kind of thinking this for the first time right as I'm talking to you right now. I think it's that because back in the late 90s the gap between the starting point default settings of whatever you bought at Best Buy and what you could calibrate and tweak that system to become, because that was a greater gap and more readily obvious. I feel as though the home theater crowd has wanted to maintain that gap, even as the starting point keeps getting better and better and easier and easier. We're like, well, if the starting point is already pretty darn good, but I'm the home theater aficionado and I care about this more than your average person, then the gap between the new starting point and where I end up has to be just as big as the gap used to be back in the 90s. And that means I have to go further and further to something that I am less and less willing to believe for myself or for anyone I'm giving advice to makes sense. I feel like the pursuit of ideal home theater is becoming less and less sensical. I feel like it's getting a little bit overbearing, a little bit nuts.
Why?
That's just my personal feeling.
But that's like, so let me see, I look at it as a positive thing, watching the growth and watching the changes. And yeah, the gap is tighter now, of course. Yeah. But you're also going back to in the late 90s, late 90s started, you know, technically started in 97, which was when DVD started. Because, you know, 90, what would you say, like mid 90s would be till 90, you know, 95, 94, 95, 96, late 90s, 97, DVD launches, right?
Yeah.
So when DVD launched, that brought Laserdisc technology to the masses. Okay. Sure. It's basically Laserdisc. It's just smaller.
Pretty close, right? Yeah. More convenient form factor.
It's actually the exact same thing. Still 480, you know, 480. Yeah. We upgraded it to progressive. It's the Dolby Digital brought over from Laserdisc. It's the exact same thing. There was a huge debate at the time on which was better, and the Laserdisc crowd thought Laserdisc was still better.
Of course, yeah.
Anyways, but now this comes to the masses. Price point on the DVDs, $19.99, same as VHS. Right, yeah. But at the time, we had VHS, and we had people with large VHS collections. Mm-hmm. VHS couldn't play Dolby Digital. It couldn't do all these. So you did have a gap. I took many people shopping to Circuit City, and they and salesmen trying to sell them a receipt. I want to get into what you kind of do here, but I have a large VHS collection, and you're telling me, like, these are all in Dolby stereo. And if you add ProLogic to this, you're going to be able to get a lot out of it with just this receiver. So we would go into a Circuit City, and Circuit City salesman would be like, well, you want to get this one here because it's got the Dolby Digital surround and blah, 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 and five discrete channels, which this person's never going to touch with his 200 VHS tapes, right?
Oh, sure. Okay. And,
but they were trying to sell it at the time like, oh, no, you can still get it. Nope.
Understandably, it's the new thing.
Yeah, but it wasn't compatible. You needed to have a DVD player. You needed to have a DVD with Dolby Digital on it. Some of them at the time didn't even have it. That was like...
That's more sales.
Yeah, I know, but it was incorrect. But I'm sitting there trying to tell them, like, I don't need to spend the $1,000 on that receiver. The $250 one's going to blow this guy away. But look at... Now, that's just to point out, there was a huge gap because there were different technologies advancing.
Yeah.
Today, the gap from HD to 4K on most people's systems isn't even that great, but it is a gap. Okay. Sure. Depending on how big your screen is, you might see it. You're going to see a difference, but the progression has always been there. We will progress from here. That's how they sell product. And as a home theater enthusiast, part of it for a lot of people, a lot of our listeners, it's not just the pushing play part, right? It's the technology. It's the, what can I upgrade to next?
Well,
what can I do next? That's the fun of it. And to me, that's the fun, like the next piece of technology, the next piece of how do I progress from here? And it's going to be when you get to a certain point, to your point, it's going to be incremental.
You're going to be paying a lot of money
to get the next piece costs this much. That's what it is.
Yeah. No, again, I mean, you and I are agreeing. We're just, I think, talking about slightly different.
Yeah. But my question gradations. Is like, why does that sadden you? Right.
Like, it's because, so like out, you know, I mentioned like out of that 100,000 people that we see as common listeners amongst all the home theater YouTube and home theater podcasts, out of that group, only a tiny fraction of that 100,000 actually writes comments. Correct. Or emails. Yeah. Or even on social media, only a small fraction of, yeah, even the 100,000, which is a tiny, tiny percentage of the population at large. You know, so what we get as podcasters, what we get as feedback is a tiny portion of a tiny portion of, right, a tiny portion of people. But it's difficult to, like, especially on AV Rant being question and answer, we're directly relying on people writing to us,
right?
You know, so yeah, it's you know, there's no avoiding it in the current format that AV Rant is running at. So what's saddening me, you know, when I say that on an emotional level, is that naturally the only tiny portion of people who are writing in are predominantly the people who are getting to like the absolute fringes, right? We're oh, moving to, right? And the comments that you see on the home theater YouTube channels, it's like you get these, what I at this point consider inane arguments, because it's like, okay, here's my method of setting things up with Dirac. Here's how I think it works best in my home theater system. And I'm going to write out this long forum post or this long comment on YouTube or whatever it is and explain my method. And then along comes the other YouTube commenter who says, well, I also use Dirac and I also do 9 out of the 10 things you do. But now you and I, fellow YouTube commenter, have to have what becomes a progressively weirdly ugly argument about that 10th thing that we do slightly differently between us. And that bums me out. It bums me out that the most enthusiastic, the most engaged home theater people that we have, the ones who actually care enough and take the time enough to write,
yeah,
to the rest of us, are going down these paths of getting into stuff that I just don't think matters or matters, but doesn't justify what just, it feels icky to me. So many of the comments, so much of the conversation, it just feels icky to me. Like here's, I'll get even more into what bums me, Rob, personally out and not in the generalizations. It's like, we all know who the popular home theater YouTubers are.
Mm-hmm.
You're doing a fantastic job on your podcast of having as many of them on as guests, casual conversations. You know, you have interest in common and, mm-hmm, you're becoming very friendly that way. And you would certainly say at this point, you're outright friends with some of those people that you've met.
Yeah.
But if not right out friends, then at least friendly on good terms. And it's like, yeah, that's the way it should be. And we should be able to have those conversations. We're clearly a very tiny group of people,
yep,
who are not just writing emails to other home theater people. We're actually making a podcast or putting something, right, on YouTube, which is another step to take, which is an even obviously tinier group of people doing that. And it's like, yeah, we should all be friends. We should all be getting along. It should be easy. And what bums me out is I personally, and this is truly me, because you're a clear example of not being the way I am, but I'm like, I kind of don't want to.
Sorry,
like,
buddy. I had to laugh, yeah, at, no, that. I'm like, I love you so much. It's so funny.
No, but I'm like,
we said that personally, like in our private conversations, like, oh my God, you are not me.
Yeah. No, but I mean, I find myself not wanting to talk to the other people who are online, publicly available, and clearly the most similar to myself, like,
yeah,
because we've gone down every subset to the point of we are now home theater enthusiasts who make a podcast or home theater enthusiasts who put something on YouTube. Like we should be the most similar. We should get along the best. We should be the most excited to talk to each other. But there is this rather large portion of me personally that's like, I kind of don't want to, not because I don't think I'd get along well with Shane Lee or get along with Joe or get along with, you know, Youth Man or like any of these guys. I'm sure any of us could get along perfectly well one-on-one, but there is this audience side of it It's a tiny, tiny number of our audience members, but they are amongst the small group who do leave comments and who do find us on social media and who do write emails. And some of that feedback is a bummer. It's a real, real, to me, like, yeah. I'm not able to just slough it off. Yeah. I get the advice of, hey, someone's a bummer, just block them, just ignore them, whatever, right?
You just ignore it. It's like,
but from, because of whatever anxieties and, you know, proneness to depression or whatever that I have in my personal life.
Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, everybody's got something, yep. right?
You know, trust me, like, I got a list.
Yeah. I mean, because of that on the personal side for me, I'm like, it's a bummer that unfortunately, like I think this is a unfortunate thing for me and for the other people that I could be conversing with, right? Like it's like, I just cost benefit ratio again. It comes back to that. Yeah. I'm like, because I don't have a ton of, I wish I had more free time. You know, I don't have a ton of free time. So can I get into a conversation with other YouTubers and stuff like that? Can we go down these rabbit holes? It's going to end up like, not that we wouldn't enjoy it, but I don't have the time to dedicate to it. Unfortunately, that's not a choice that is thrust upon me. But then if we do that, you know, and it's, that's out there, that's public, or I'm talking about someone in particular, even on AV Ramp, because of course we get the people who ask us specific questions about something they saw on a fellow YouTuber's channel, and they want to know exactly what we think about what they said. And that's the part where I go, okay, wait a second. Because we're back to the old forum days of, okay, am I going to go point by point, like the annoying people, the people I found annoying on the forums,
right,
who were like, I see something that I agree with 85% of it, but that 15%, I have to make a point by point list of why they're wrong and why I'm right. And we're going to have that weird forum back and forth that often devolves into stupidness. And we get that similar sort of thing where it's like, okay, I'm being asked, what do you think about so-and-so YouTuber's approach to this topic? And I'm like, I agree with 95% of it.
Yep.
And the 5% that I would maybe do slightly differently myself, it's not worth worrying about. Like that's my, like, really, that's what I feel like. Cause I'm like, the difference that 5% is going to make to anyone else, I don't think is worth anything. I don't think it's worth anything at all. In a true value proposition to anyone else I'm going to be talking about. And like, I can give that answer. You haven't heard it yet because this week's episode hasn't come out as you and I are recording what we're doing right now. I gave that answer on this week's episode of AV Rant because people have been asking some specific questions about some stuff that some YouTubers have been posting, you know, fairly recently. And I'm like, I publicly say this on AV Rant. I don't want to get into it. Not that I have zero interest. Not that I don't think I understand what's going on or don't want to talk about from that, but I don't want to get into it because any minor disagreement, if you would want to use that word, any minor change that I might make or any evaluation that I might have between these different approaches, I think is so worthless that I don't want to invite the feedback that I know will come from even talking about it. And that bums me out. It bums me out that I don't even want to talk about it publicly because I know there's going to be two stupid YouTube commenters who are going to make it a bummer for me. That sucks. I don't like that.
So yeah, I get those questions as well.
Yeah.
Probably not the volume you do because you're a question and answer podcast.
But we don't get that many though.
Do get questions from people about other people's channels or something they heard in a podcast or a YouTube. Yeah. And I answer those off air. And it's like you said, it's 95% accurate.
Yeah.
It's that 5% of either inaccurate. It's an omitted piece. Like something like they didn't say, okay, here's what such and such said. And they're correct. And they're asking me like, why, but what, but that's different from what you say. Correct. Sure. Cause they're leaving out the part that you have to do this as well. So you see how that adds up. And they did. So that's one example where it's an item that's omitted. So this is what they're saying. They're 100% right, but I don't want to say they're lying by omission, but they're saying something.
Oh God, no. Well, because I mean, you and I
omission, But then
yeah, you and I as podcasters know this, which is that, you know, this recording is going to be up there for anyone to find for as long as it remains available. There's stuff that we haven't said in the hour that we've been talking right now, not because we don't know it or we don't care about it or we didn't think it was worth saying, but because we're having a conversation and stuff gets left out and we need to keep the conversation moving.
Right.
And it's like, it wasn't intentional to leave something out, or we might've thought about it, but then we forgot to get back to it because we're two humans having a conversation.
Right.
But then somebody gets to see the recording of it and they get to write down, here's the thing that they missed. Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's a weird, a weird parasocial way to have a conversation.
Different. It's like, but anyways, not to get into those nitty gritties, but then there's other cases where it's like, all right, they're telling you how to do something, but they're missing other issue parts, maybe just out of their newer edit, you know, they just don't know, like, whatever. But it's always it's only a difference, like you said, of about 5%. And sometimes it's just preference, right? It's just
absolutely
they prefer their settings like this, and that's what you get throughout. But what I was going to say is, it's funny because I understand completely what you're saying. Your, the name of your podcast of AV Rant is set up to exactly progress into where I think it's like years ago listening to you guys, Tom ranted, you answered. You're getting closer to, you're both ranting. Because like you
said. Are we? Okay.
Well, you're getting more frustrated with, like you just said, the questions are getting into more of the nitty gritty where you would prefer, it sounds like you're saying you would prefer, like, how do I get started? Like what do I need to get to get a good home theater? And
that's not unfair to say that. Yeah. Okay.
Right. Okay. So, but your listeners you're probably getting new listeners in, but the majority, you've been around so long. Even you, Rob, have been there for over 10 years now, right?
I know it goes too quickly, but yes.
Right. So your listenership has all progressed into that level. So they're trying to get to the nitty gritty when you are trying to say, like, you're a person, and I respect this, you're a person that's like, I got what I got. This is great. And I, like, I did all the right homework at the beginning and you're done. Now you just want to enjoy the content. When there is the part of the hobby where a lot of your listenership is like, but I want the next piece. I want to try that next piece, but you don't, and you're getting frustrated because you're like, you don't need it. Well, I know I don't need it, which is one of my rants yesterday on Takeover Tuesday. Like, you don't need that. I know.
I want to turn this more positive, you know, like,
laughing. I'm having a great time, Rob. It's all positive. But I mean,
I've been talking about why I've been a little bit emotionally bummed out related to home theater. I want to turn it back to the positive side for myself, which is that I am glad that I set for myself and I have maintained for myself a guiding North Star when it comes to everything that I do publicly on a podcast, on a YouTube channel, however small it might be. That stuff is still public. Someone can view it and they can respond to it and have feedback in whatever manner that they want. There's a certain vulnerability to that, right? Anytime you put yourself out there publicly in any capacity, there is a certain vulnerability that comes with that. And I'm glad that I set for myself and have kept it. I just want to make the podcast that I personally want to listen to. And I need to remind myself of that almost daily. Because when I am reading emails and, you know, it'll be a question. It's a good question. And I'm reading that question and I'm like, I am interested in getting into this, but I ask myself in terms of how I'm going to respond on a podcast, I want to make the podcast that I want to listen to. So even for me, as technical as I will get on AV Rant sometimes, as into the weeds and into the nitty gritty as I will get, there is a certain amount of either holding myself back or being careful with my words, you know, to not put as much of my own emotional reaction or evaluation into something as my first blush reaction might have been. I'll try to temper that in on the podcast because I want this to be the podcast that I personally want to listen to. And that's a weird yardstick, right? Because of course it's unavoidable that the podcast I want to listen to is not going to be the podcast that everybody wants to listen to. And there's going to be the people who go, Rob gets way too technical as it is. Dumb it down, please. And then there's going to be the people who are like, you don't get technical enough or you don't get specific enough. And that's fair. That's completely fair. But for me, to keep doing the podcast, I have to be able to say I'm happy doing what I'm doing. And for me, that's I want to make the podcast that I want to listen to. So,
right.
You know, that's been the positive for me, is that I think that's kept me steady. That's kept me from flying off the handle, or it's kept me from getting into trouble, or it's kept me from getting into unpleasant interactions that I just don't want to have. Right. There are a very, very tiny number of people who have written into AV Rant that when their name shows up, I just ignore. I don't look at what they have to say. And I mean, this is a really, really tiny number of people. And it's unfortunate, because maybe what they're saying today is worth my conversation. But because of something that they said in the past, I'm just like, no, you're dead to me. Unfortunately, effectively, it's just like, I'm not even going to look at the body of your social media post or your comment or your email. I'm not going to look at it whatsoever. I saw your name, and that's enough for me to say, nope, done. Like, that isn't a bummer to me. Because I'm like, I want to make the podcast that I want to listen to.
That's all you can do. Yeah.
Including that's like, I'm not under any obligation to be completely objective. I have no obligation to do that on AV Rant, the podcast. Like, we never made that promise.
You stress yourself out so much trying to be.
Yeah, we're not nope. subject to some kind of laws outside of ourselves. We can make the rules for
you
what we do.
You and I have argued about it. I'm like, you work so hard at being objective, and I'm the exact opposite. I'm like, no, everything's subjective.
Yeah, but that's because that's the podcast I want to be.
Right, but it's so impossible to be completely objective, because it's just impossible. It's like, because you have your opinions, and other people are going to have their opinions of you. So it's like, there's no such thing as a perfect anything. And all you can do, and is do the podcast you want to do. And it's like, because if you don't, you wouldn't have been doing it for 10 years.
I spin out.
You'd get tired of it. You'd be like, this isn't for me. I'm doing this because I was told to do this. And that's not the case. And I've had this conversation. We've talked about it publicly. Steve, when he joined the show, and it was, and John and I have talked, I told John about it as we were going on. It's like, John and I were doing chat, and I was doing this, and I was getting requests to do certain things with the show. And I would, early on, I tried some of it, and then I was like, no, and I can't do that. And I had no problem with veering off of it, because I am especially with an art background, I'm very subjective. Everything is subjective to me. So it's like, if I don't like doing it, it's not going to last. I'm not going to do it. Right. And when Steve joined the show, it was funny, because in the first weeks of him being on the show, he had the idea of, he goes, maybe we should do, it was something like, you know, we'll do a movie a week where we all watch that movie, and we'll do this, and then we'll advertise it, and that'll help this. I got those requests from listeners for years and years before that. And I laughed, and I was like, Steve, here's what happens. I go, it seems like a great idea. It personally happened with my family. They got all stressed out. We did movie night, and it was like, there were four people in the house.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it came around once a month. You had to pick a movie.
Okay. Yes.
3 months into this, everybody was stressed out, because they were out of their top three, and they didn't know what to pick next. They didn't want to make somebody upset.
Somehow it becomes work, right?
Exactly.
Somehow it becomes a point of stress, weirdly.
And what was nice is, I've talked about that on the show so many times, and because I have, the requests have stopped. Even new listeners aren't asking us to do something like that. But it's like Steve, and I explained it to Steve, and I'm like, here we are. Steve's been on the show almost 2 years now. Yeah. And it's like, could you imagine if you had homework, but now you've got your life involved, you've got something else. And it's like, for me, I realize it, I'm like, I don't know what I'm going to watch next. I mean, I was watching a movie the other day, and it was, we were talking about, Steve and I were talking about, Tomb Raider, the newest Tomb Raider movie, right? Here's how my brain's working. I'm watching the newest Tomb Raider. Early on in the movie, there's a bicycle chase scene. I'm thinking, wow, that's a great scene. I haven't seen that movie in forever. Oh my God. I'd love to see Quicksilver. Quicksilver was from the 80s, a bicycle movie. Oh, I would love to see that. I looked it up. I'm like, ah, crap. It's only an SD on Kaleidoscape. If it was in HD, I would have bought it and watched that next. But instead, I mentioned that on the show. What did we talk about? Premium Rush. Steve and I watched Premium Rush the next week, which is a bike chase. But do you see what I mean? It's the emotional motivation that gets you into the next movie. Sometimes it's like, it's a cameo in a movie like, oh my God, Kevin Bacon. I haven't seen him in a while. I haven't seen Quicksilver. There you go again. Right. So it's like but when somebody tells you, we're going to watch this next week.
Right. Yeah.
But then you got to fit it in with all the stuff that you're motivated to watch. And you're like, oh, now I got to see. And then maybe you don't want to watch it. And that's where I think a lot of movie critics get in. They're like, a movie critic. I have to sit down and watch this movie. And they're not in the mood or whatever. And and going back to your show, you just got to do what you want to do and you happy. And you're right. Not everybody's going to like it, but that's okay. Right. And I've said that to listeners in the past. I'm like, I'm fine if you don't like it because I have people that like it. If I change it to what you like, I will lose people that liked it the other way. So I'm never going to make everybody happy. I just got to make me happy.
a small number of subscribers that we don't really have to worry about that number going down. We're not beholden to any sponsors who are expecting our viewership to go up or anything like that. So that's very easy on that side. But I think just to wrap up, you know, this generalized topic that I've been on. I mean, I guess all I'm getting at is, very often I think the answer I kind of want to give, I end up being of two minds because there's the absolute geek side of me that would like to go into ridiculous nitty gritty details and technical stuff about it. And that is part of my mind. And the other side of me is the answer I very often want to give is just chill out. just don't worry about it. And I feel like I do a fairly decent job of striking that balance in the responses that I do give on AV Rant because I'll be like, okay, here's the me digging into it. But my real answer is don't even worry about it that much. Like,
I think that's fair.
Here's how much effort I think you should put into it. And here's what I think is worthwhile for just about anybody who's got enough interest to even ask the question. And then here's some further details if you want to go that nuts, but I don't really even think it's worth your while. But then there is another level in the response that could be given that's even beyond that, which to my mind is where the unpleasant comments and the unpleasant forum back and forths end up going. They end up going to that even further degree.
Right.
Of getting to the last 1 or 2% and then weirdly having an argument about it. So what I would like to do for our conversation here is like transition into what has been, I think, somewhat broadly amongst YouTube channels and podcasts and forums, and then has been, I know for sure, a topic that people have been asking about on AV Rant specifically. But I just want to get DJ's take on this. Let's put aside other people for a moment and just get your take on it, because I'm sure this has come up with you. It will be when you're fully finalizing your theater, right?
Yeah.
When all the construction is done and everything is completely installed, you're going to be at that stage where a lot of people are of, okay, you're finally running your equalization system, whatever one you're going to be going with and whatever method you're going to be using to adjust it. And it is this ongoing debate that we have of, okay, what is that darn target curve supposed to be? Because this is, what is very understandably throwing everybody who's having this conversation online about what is this darn target curve supposed to be is the fact that we do not have an industry standardized target curve. Unlike video, where we have the industry standard targets that you can objectively measure and either exactly hit, or if you don't hit them, you know exactly how much you missed them by. And then you can tune to personal taste after that. If you like your reds to be a little deeper, whatever it is, that's fine. But we know unequivocally, objectively, exactly what the industry standard was, but we do not have that in audio. We don't have some kind of industry-wide, exactly this target curve, and we measure exactly how far away we are from that. It's a little bit nebulous. It's a little bit to taste. It's a little bit fuzzy.
It's more than that. But yes.
Yeah. And so I just want to get DJ's take. How do you go after your target curve? What's your approach for, like, here's the target curve I'm going to go after?
So you just want my flat answer, which is flat.
Whatever response you want to give.
You want pun intended, not intended. I didn't even mean that. But it's like,
yeah.
So there's multiple reasons why there's differences. And we've had conversations with listeners about this.
Yeah.
Video is a lot easier. It's much easier to define, right?
Yes.
So like,
well, it is defined. It has been defined for us an industry.
It's defined as this is the starting point. Objectively, here's your starting point. When you tune to taste from there, it's so if you're flat out colorblind, you'll know.
Sure.
No, and I'm not joking. I'm saying so most of our vision is pretty much in the same. When we get glasses, it's not to adjust color tint and stuff like that. It's to adjust your ability to focus, correct?
Yeah.
So other than that, we have no idea I have no idea what colors you're seeing, right? Mm. I have no idea you shake your head, but it's like, what if, like, if I swapped brains and all of a sudden you're like, wait a minute, that's blue. Nope, that's red.
Right,
in your head, it looks like, so you have no idea, but in your, because it's all an interpretation by your brain. But here's the color wheel. Here's this. We can look at a color wheel. We can look at all of these things and define it.
Here are the measured wavelengths, right? So that's that. No. Well,
what I'm saying is, like, you look at a crayon box, you know, the red, the blue, the yellow, you know, all of these things, right? So we can define all of that very simply. Mm-hmm. Here, we'll set up back in the SMPTE. We'll set up our color bars and we can calibrate a television to a starting point. And to your point, it's like tune to taste. All right. I like my reds a little bit hotter, or I like this. Now that could be the case of, because of the way you see reds, you might need that a little hotter. And that when I tuned, if say I tuned my reds a little hotter than you, you'd be like, that's too red. That's wrong. Yeah. But in my mind, it looks right. Right. So.
Sure. But I mean, we could bust out a meter and know exactly what wavelength it is. And then there is an industry standard.
Right.
Where it's like, it's either that or it isn't. And that's the end of the.
But when somebody deviates from it, it doesn't mean it's wrong. It's just that's their perception. Okay.
Yeah. No, but I mean, it means though that they have deviated from something that is defined somewhere.
Defined as a starting point. It's a defined.
Well, I mean, not in the industry. In the industry, the starting point is also the end point, right? Like, what I'm getting at is, if you're someone making a movie and you're a colorist making a Hollywood movie, even if that colorist perceives colors a little bit differently from the person next to them, that on their monitors, there will be no difference. There will be no tuning to taste.
And that's why.
In that professional
because
setting.
Because they're sending it out to many, many variables.
Yeah.
They're sending it out to studios. They're sending it out to movie theaters. They're sending it out. It's going to go out. And you need to have that starting point. Okay. And then,
For them, it's also for them, it's also the end point. Like, there is no deviation from that in the making of the content.
Correct.
And therefore, we're able to easily and objectively say, if my display at home is the exact same as the displays that were used professionally to make it, then we have that. Like that's, yep. that's just defined. That's yep. just objective. And then if I choose to deviate from that, I can measure and know exactly how much I deviated from it.
Correct.
It's clear.
And now you have a preference. Now you have your sure. reference preference, sure. right? Yeah. So it's like, say I need to deviate off of red this much to get the mm-hmm. exact picture that I prefer. Right. So,
but if you prefer something different from me, we can have that, not even disagreement, just personal taste.
Not even a disagreement. It's just a taste. But I like chocolate. You like vanilla. That's not an argument.
But we're essentially forced to agree on exactly the measured, I will be able to say, here is exactly how far off of what 100% red is defined. Mm-hmm. to be by the industry, and here's where I put it and here's where you put it, and there's no wiggle room for argument. It's like, nope, that's just it, that's the thing. But right. yes, to get to the whole point, sound is different, audio is different.
Sound now, but see, here's the thing, we have two eyes looking at a display regardless mm-hmm. of what the technology of the display is. That's it. That's all that goes into our perception of the image, right?
Okay.
Two things. That's it. Sound, you have a processor. You have amplification. You have, and I mean, you got to put it in the chain. You have wires. They're not as important sure. as a lot of people think they are, but they're in there. Then you have speakers. Mm-hmm. We're still not done yet.
Nope.
The biggest thing left before it even gets to your two ears mm-hmm. is the room. Mm-hmm. You have five variables. Then now
even
let's
more,
get,
yes, but yeah,
but I'm just saying those five variables go up to make the frequencies that you're going to hear.
That's now, right. What reaches your ear?
Yep. Right. Now get into your ear. Mm-hmm. What frequency ranges are you sensitive to? Why are some people like my son? He can't listen to people grab styrofoam.
Sure.
It bothers yep. them. There's yep. people are hypersensitive to certain frequency ranges. So how do you define a standard on mm-hmm. something that's like, what you have you can't control almost any of those variables anywhere?
Well, I mean, you could define a standard, right? Because I mean, a standard is just like when people say reference, that unfortunately has taken on occasionally a little bit of a weird connotation in home theater, because some people have equated the word reference with a like how good it is, right?
No,
like,
reference is always a starting point. That's what right. reference
it's,
means.
It really just means, yes, a frame of reference. So in terms of audio, we could define a standard. Like you could say, these are the dimensions of the standardized room. These are the construction materials of the standardized room. This is exactly how much acoustic treatment goes into the standardized room and where it gets placed. These are the standardized speakers. These are the standard, like you could define, exactly yeah, some
RP
sort of standardized
room. RP22 tried to do that.
Not particularly. That's more just giving a common language, but you could also, you could simplify it all to saying, here is the standardized model head with the chosen microphones that are inside the ears of the model head. And the frequency response that reaches those microphones inside of those model head ears, that's the curve. That's what it should be, regardless
should
of all
be for
the
who,
other
Rob?
Variables.
Because you,
I'm just saying,
for a second, you just set up a room. So right away, you just alienated everybody that can't duplicate that room.
Well,
and
not
then
necessarily,
you just
because
said, this is what should reach your ears.
No,
you don't
saying
know what the
could.
Listener is going to interpret that as.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm saying you could hypothetically set that as a standard. That, hypothetically speaking, the industry could choose if they wanted to set that as a standard. And then just like video, you could say, okay, everybody can measure for that specific industry-wide standard. If you tune it to taste, that's fine. That's up to you. But now we have this, thing in common that we could all refer back to and measure and say, this is exactly, it's just a reference. It's a point of reference. We could all refer back to it. That theoretically could be done. And Sean Olive is out there on the headphone side of things, making the argument that, hey, here's all the evidence we've gathered that this is the Harman headphone target curve. He's got different ones depending on which model head and which microphone inside of the ears of those model heads is being used. Cause he's like, yeah, you can't take one website's headphone measurements and compare them literally apples for apples against another website because they might be using two different model heads. So the curves inside of those two heads are going to be, but he's saying like, okay, we've basically got between 3 and 5 standardized model heads that are sort of out there in the world. And we should be able to create therefore 3 to 5 different headphone target curves. Cause in headphones, we've removed a lot of the external variables. We have a lot less space between the what's creating the sound and the thing that's receiving the sound. So Sean Olive is out there saying like, here's our evidence in all of the, research that Harman has done of why we think this Harman headphone target curve makes the most sense, not the least of which is purely on the business and practical side of things, what sells the most, right? If you deviate, if you tune your headphones to wildly deviate from this target curve, do they sell better or worse, right? Completely take other forms, other metrics of measurement out of it, just what sells better. And he's like, look, the evidence suggests that the closer you get to these Harman target curves, the more satisfied customers are and the better your sales are. And if you started with a model of headphones that wildly deviated from the Harman headphone target curve, And on iteration 2, if you make that curve closer to the Harman headphone target curve, they sell better, right? So he's out there making that argument at lots of different conventions and things like that. And then he has people pushing back on that saying, why do we want all headphones to end up sounding the same, right? Isn't it great that we have, and he's like, yeah, it is great to have headphones. So he's just like, if we're going to have anything that we can call a reference standard, then eventually we have to agree this is the reference standard, then go from there what you want to do it. So what I'm saying is, hypothetically, we could create that for listening in a room as well. Hypothetically, we could just say, here's the reference standard, and then we can all go back to that. But at the moment, we don't have that. We don't have a singular reference standard that everybody can say, okay, that's at least, like you've been saying, a starting point. That's at least something where everybody can say, whether I like it or not, it's a common thing that we can all agree on. We could hypothetically do that. But in the absence of that, because I mean, that's basically the debate that's going on YouTube channels and forums and podcasts right now, because we've got all of these different, room correction programs, right? Horrible name, but room correction programs. We know what I mean when I say those words. We got all of those. They have their default target curves. Most of them now give you some way of being manually able to adjust to your own manual target curve. Then we now have this new layer of like, okay, wait a second. I can download the saved file from my room correction program. I can get that out of my phone or I can get that out of my computer. Then I can import that into Room EQ Wizard or another program. I can run a script on it, whether it's one that I wrote or one that somebody else wrote. It makes some alterations to that file and then I re-upload it back into my system. And now that's a target curve that I either wasn't the default or I couldn't have reached it with the adjustment capabilities that are built into the program.
Right.
And it's like, that's a whole new, relatively new thing, more readily available thing is, I guess, a better way to put it. That's come up now and we have the people debating, okay, which version is better? And it's like, well, in the absence of an industry standard reference that we can all point back to and say, well, here's exactly how much each of these various systems deviates from their effort. Like, it's a completely nebulous argument because, like you're saying, subjectively, what one person thinks sounds better, which in this, it really just means more pleasing to me. That's all that means. Shrunk down to a single word. It's not better. It's just more pleasing to me. But we're going to argue about like, should I spend the money for this one versus this one? Should I use the default target? I mean, everybody everybody who talks about this online seems to be under the impression that none of us can use the default target curve of any of these. They're all garbage. Every default target curve has to be garbage because it's possible to change it. Like, that's a right. weird logic in my mind.
Well,
so I have to get back. I have to bring us back onto my artificial track that I've laid down here. I haven't gotten an answer from DJ. When you are tuning your system, what is the target curve that DJ is going for?
I honestly don't know yet. I need to hear, okay. I need to hear the room. Right. I'll tell you, it's like what I'm shooting for is exactly what I have in this room. It's like, okay. I'm trying to get, so whatever, I've gone as flat as possible. I just want, I don't even like.
Okay. So when you say flat, cause even that is unfortunately, a little bit, it's possible to be a little bit, squishy on exactly what flat means. So when you say flat, do you mean I set, U-Mic 1 into my primary listening position and mm-hmm. the graph on Room EQ Wizard is a flat line? Or do you mean, like, what do you mean by flat?
I want everything playing, like all free. I bump nothing and I don't want a drop off if I don't have to have it. I want it flat, all frequencies running. That's the way I've set my room up now. There is a drop off now because it's the inherent, it's the one that Odyssey EQ does their drop off at what? The high frequency roll off at the end.
Oh, there's a little high frequency roll off.
Yeah,
in it, sure.
But that's, there's reason, I forget what it exactly is, but there's reasons that exists. It's not necessary. Oh, yes. But there's reasons it exists.
And it could change it.
Well, you can change it, but most of it is mm-hmm. about your room's capabilities. They roll those off. Forgive me,
speaker
listeners.
Speaker capability too. Yeah.
Well, but it's more about like those frequencies continuing within the room. Whereas if you roll them off, it's like, and it's all about room treatments. So mm-hmm. like if you have your room set up correctly, like in real world environment, when somebody fires a gun, the higher frequencies mm-hmm. of that gunshot don't roll off. Mm-hmm. They roll away.
Right.
They keep going, right?
Because
you're in an open field, right? Mm-hmm. Or if somebody screeches really loud, in an open field, mm-hmm. they don't roll off the higher frequencies. They just roll away. They keep going. So we have roll-offs to prevent that sound, that screech from bouncing off your back wall and coming back to you. Right. So they roll that off because even though like, so say your roll off set at like 15K and you start rolling off there, anything at 16K, you've heard it. I didn't need it that loud for me to hear it, but now we're preventing it from bouncing back at you. Okay. Mm-hmm. But if you have room treatments or sound correction, audio correction that are in the higher mm-hmm. end, you know, with the Trinovs and the Storms where that's one of their thing. They can run, if you're running full frequencies, mm-hmm. you might be able to run flat all the way across mm-hmm. because it isn't coming back at you. Okay. Mm. So in answer to your question, I don't know because I don't know what system I'm going to have to start. Yep. My end game system would be a Trinov or a Storm.
Sure.
And to be able to utilize some of this stuff and see what that sounds like at flat, that would be because now we're duplicating a real world environment without walls. That's our ultimate goal in our theaters. So mm-hmm. to your point, the arguments online, they're all based in the reason that it's so hard to have a standard or a reference for audio is one of the most subjective things out there. So definitely. If you set a reference, you're going to alienate so many people on either side of that reference.
Right.
I have Giles. I love telling this story. We talked about it on the show. We've talked about it personally. We laugh about it. Mm-hmm. He thought Oppenheimer had too much bass.
Okay.
And the first thing I asked him, are you running your subs hot? Oh, yeah. Right. I always run my subs hot. It's like 5 to 7 dB hot.
Yeah.
Well, does Oppenheimer have too much bass or does it have a lot of bass? And now you're boosting that, right?
Yeah.
And we laugh about it. And that's one of the things. And I love using that example because Giles is one of those people that is highly respected and mm-hmm. he's doing something and then he makes a critique about something, but his system, his critique of the system, his system's the problem, not the movie,
right?
Right. And, but, But, and that's why I love using it, because like I'm friends with Giles. I can say that. I can tell him that and we laugh about it. But if you say that in a forum, yeah, but most movies aren't that way and blah, 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 blah. And I've got to do it this way. I'm like, yes, but you can't criticize something if you're altering.
Well, yeah, to say that the people who made the content made a mistake.
Correct.
Right.
And that's what goes on in the forums. That's what goes on in the forums.
Oh,
you got people running stuff hot left and right. My overheads are hot or this is that. And I get all that. I when I first started getting overhead, I wanted them hot. And actually for me, it wasn't my overheads. This was back in the '90s when I got discretes in the rear. I ran those hot as hell.
Yeah. Because I want to notice them, right?
Oh my God. Every time I install a home theater for somebody brand new in my life, I want to hear more out of the back channels.
That's right.
And it's progressed to today when I've done
the
Sonos.
That's the new thing I didn't have before, so I want to notice them.
And you know what I tell them? Listen to commercials. Just listen to commercials. They run those rear channels so hot because they were like, whoa! It's like, so, and it's the new thing. But when you progress to, like, if you run those hot, now you're you'll realize over time you're overpowering your other channels in legit scenes that need to be run appropriately. It's going to misplace items. Yeah. Like, that sounds supposed to sound like it's coming over here, but because that's hot, it's going to pull it in that direction. So, in answer to your question, I mean, flat is the best description I can give. And that's what I try to achieve regardless of the system, the audio calibration system I use.
Okay.
That's what I'm going for. And that's one of the reasons I want to get to a Trinov Storm someday, something like that.
Sure.
Or that's one of the reasons I'm excited to run five full channels, but even the side channels are going to be able to go down to 40. And to be able to, let's see where this goes. I'm at that point. You're right, Rob. It's a lot of money for this crap. And it's a lot of money. And is it that big of a difference? Probably not. But I want to find out. And then I'll be able to tell people.
Yeah, that's fair.
And I'll walk away going, no, it's not that much of it. I love my, and I still have this theater. I'm a like 2 mile drive away from coming back to this theater and going,
Yeah,
they're pretty damn close. When I was at Cedia, I said live from Cedia, I'm like, guys, we are not far away from these $1 million theaters. We aren't. Right, yeah. We are not.
Yes. That has been my point too. Right, yeah.
It's like, you are not. And they're fantastic. And even those weren't set up the way I liked. My wife liked it better. Like the Grimani Theater, she loved that theater. She loved it. And you know, one of the things she loved about it, the bass it wasn't as tactile as what we have here.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It was very nice. It was very,
very
discreet,
uniform, I'm
very
sure.
Very uniform throughout the room. Oh my God. Yeah. Uniform. Ridiculous. Yeah. But when like in some of those scenes where I know at home, I get that tactile boom in the chest or a rumble that would come up through the seat. And it's different.
Yeah,
it's
for even how well you set up your theater and how much damping and decoupling you have, the amount of damping that Grimani has in his systems is like, that's decoupled. That's full on decoupled what he does now. But so it's like that little bit of literal physical vibration that you're getting is like, nope, that ain't happening in the systems that he's got.
Right. Well, no, there is some like when I go to the district.
No, but I mean sheer from sound waves in his, right? Like it's like the platform that the seats are on, it's not moving. It's not vibrating. It's,
no. And I like that though. I want that little bit because that's how I know like different frequencies are doing different things. So when a gunshot goes off and you feel that shotgun blast in your chest, didn't vibrate my seat. It actually put a punch in my chest. But then you'll get a bass sweep or a bass rumble, like a car engine start and it goes boom. And you feel it in your seat, but you didn't feel it in your chest. That's two different bass notes. And I like feeling that. And to me, that's real world environment. Right. I think in the Grimani room, they were a little bit, you could tune that room to do that. But in there, it's a temporary structure. They're in there.
Well,
and
that's just, they had limitations too. They didn't have literal full sealed in. So you've got some pressure escaping as well.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but my wife, she's like, it gave you everything else except for that mm-hmm. big punch in the chat. And she's like, I don't like to get that. She doesn't like okay. it in my theater. She doesn't like it anywhere. Dolby cinemas
have yeah.
that. Right?
Well, they have tactile transducers in them as well. So correct. You've got, so you've got things that aren't even speakers and right. air sound. It's but actual physical have enough, vibration.
They do not have enough pressurization for the punch oh, yes. to the chest, too.
Yeah.
So she IMAX, doesn't I'm like sure that. Well, right? And that's what I yeah. like in my theater. So mm-hmm. when I'm running, and here's like, I'm sure there's a segment of listeners right now going, well, then you must be running your bass hot. No, because mm-hmm. you don't need to run it hot to get those feelings.
But you also do something that's kind of rare, which is you listen at full reference volume.
Correct.
Which not everybody's doing. And so sometimes people are like, they want the physical punch in the chest that you enjoy, mm. that you're getting while listening at reference volume. They want that same tactile experience, but not at full reference volume, right. which then means you do have to boost the bass signal up significantly.
Right.
Because that part has to be creating enough pressure to give you the physical sensation, but the master volume has been turned down however many
correct.
dB. Yeah.
But then those same people are like, why is my center channel not so clear?
Sure,
like,
yeah.
Because you're boosting up bass, which is inhibiting your center channel. It's like, it's inhibiting your perception. Yeah. It's funny, every time I go to somebody's house, most recently we were at one of my listeners, Mike Schramm's house, and my yeah. son's with me, right? And one of the questions was like, here's what I listen at. And he listens at minus 12. Okay. And we watched a few scenes like that, I think from Top Gun. This was right at the beginning, mm-hmm. his first question to me. Mm-hmm. And he's like, how is this compared to reference in your theater? Mm. And I said, my son and I looked at each other and I was like, it's a little low.
Okay.
And he goes, well, how much should I go up? I go, about 2 dB. And he went to minus 10.
Okay.
And it was pretty much how it sounds in my room, mm. according to my son and I. Okay.
Okay.
So he's in an open space. He mm. has minimal room treatments mm-hmm. and that's as loud as he can go
yeah.
to get to. And that's if he went to reference, it would mm. be too much.
Yeah.
Okay. And it would be yeah. too loud. At minus 10, he's mm-hmm. hearing what we would say the volume of sound that we are getting. Now, mm-hmm. the debate we have, and he has his room tuned so, so well. He didn't boost his bass too high, trying to get too much, which people tend to do in a situation like his. And then you get that, boo, 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 everything's like, sure. like the, you know, the Honda Accord going by on the highway. He didn't do that. He has so much clarity in there because he tuned mm-hmm. it appropriately.
Yeah.
Okay. And, yeah. You don't need to have that volume of mm-hmm. that reference volume of air moving to achieve the same sound. I mm. have that ability in my room. The reason you would want to get to reference someday is because mm-hmm. even in Mikey's room and stuff like that, there's a chance that very quiet scenes now sure. those are lowered, and then we have that mm-hmm. the room. I forget the EQ or whatever, where it raises that stuff. But mm-hmm. there's a
dynamic
chance
EQ or
dynamic
equivalent.
EQ. There you go, buddy. Mm-hmm. There's a chance that on those quiet scenes where a mosquito might be playing over there, because you're minus 10, that's now that's way down and you can't yes. hear it.
Below whereas the threshold of audibility there
exactly. Yeah. So, but if you can get to reference, you mm-hmm. know that you're getting everything that sure. was meant to be heard. And that's yeah. it. So, okay. I mean, he does not miss a thing in his room. It's a mm-hmm. great experience, but that's the example. Like everybody's, I can't listen at reference in my room. I know. Yeah. Cause it's all room treatments, but it's not as loud as people think. People come True. Here yep. and hear it and go, yeah. this is reference. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because they're used to turning reference up at their house. Like if Mikey yeah. Schramm did it, you'd be like, oh my God, that hurts.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, we go out to an IMAX cinema.
That's not reference.
And well, I mean, they max out at, we've got the specs now, right? Carl kindly shared that, yeah. right? For the home versions, for the luxury home versions. And they're like, yeah, you know, they're asking you to be able to sustain 122 dB. So, I mean, that's definitely above regular Cinema Reference, well above it.
Oh yeah.
Being able to sustain 122 dB. But, you know, IMAX, like, they have their reference because, you know, movies that are shown in IMAX cinemas, they are mastered for IMAX cinemas specifically.
Right.
So, I mean, they have their standardized thing. And even there, some scenes when you're watching them in IMAX are still quiet. It's that everything is literally deafeningly loud 100% of the time. There's still stuff that's quiet even there. So if you were watching that same experience at home, then it's like, yeah, that shouldn't be that much quieter. It was already quiet at the IMAX cinema. It shouldn't be 10 decibels quieter than that, to the point that you're going, I can't really make out what they're saying. But then, yeah, those massive dynamic loud peaks come in at apparently 122 decibels potentially. Right. And it's just like, oh, well, yeah, I want to turn that down 10 dB because it is literally painfully loud. So yeah, it's a bit of a struggle there. But I kind of wanted to, we're not going to make this podcast go forever and ever. So
No.
I wanted to bounce a little related idea off of you because my personal approach for, how I'm setting a target curve in my room now, has evolved a little bit. Because of some of the discussion that's going on online, but not that I've been following the advice that's going online. It got me to think in a more simplified way about what I think makes the most sense. Yeah. What makes the most sense for an equalized target curve. And I've talked about this on AV Rant a little bit. There's some repetition that I'm going to do here, but I wanted to bounce this idea off of you, see if it's something that you think makes sense and would maybe like to try. You know, I'm not saying you're going to necessarily settle on this, but it might be worth a try to you. Because I'm repeating this from AV Rant, but the simple stage that we can all agree on, if you just have an electronically generated sweep signal, so you're just talking about the electronic recording at this point, and it's just been generated and it's a sweep from 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz, all at exactly the same volume. So that's easy to understand. All right. We could see that on a graph and we're like, yep, the amplitude is exactly the same across every single frequency. Mm-hmm. And we've got pretty good consensus amongst a large majority of people that if you play that signal through a speaker that's in an anechoic chamber, that what you're going to measure on axis, and if the speaker has even off axis, but on axis, you're going to measure a flat line. It's going to be that the speaker in an anechoic chamber produced the signal that said, play all of these frequencies at exactly the same volume. That's what the speaker did. The speaker plus the amplifier plus the processor.
Yep.
That's what it did in anechoic chamber. And it was like, okay, good. We've got kind of a starting point for us now. And then we're all going to agree that you take that exact same speaker, you put it into any real life room, whether that room is acoustically treated or not, or whatever it is, and we're going to have a seating location in that room, and it's that sound is going to come out of those speakers, it's going to reach our ears, and what we measure at our seating location is somehow no longer a perfectly flat line. The room has had some impact on that. And so, okay.
Not some.
Yes.
It's all the impact, but go ahead.
It's not a perfectly flat line anymore. Something has changed and it's the effects of the room. And that can also be different from seating location to seating location, right? We're not going to have literally the exact same measured response at every seat.
Can I simplify that even further? It's not even the room. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's, when you simplify it even further, anechoic chamber or outside an open field, it's the sound is the reason the volume's changing at every frequency. It's the ability. It's that sound coming back to you. So it's like,
it's a reflection. Yeah.
It's a reflection. So you're dealing with all of those reflections. And that's what we're all dealing with. So it's like, the speaker is doing exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
It's just that laser beam. So like, imagine you lit a laser and you're in a room of mirrors. Mm-hmm. What happens?
That's right.
That's what happens in a room with sound.
That's right.
But people don't realize that. They think it's a laser and it just keeps going past you. It's like, why is it louder now? Because it's just coming back at you. And it's like,
but now we're getting into the, now we're getting into where all the confusion comes from and where all the debate comes from about when you take your measurements, whether you're doing it manually in Room EQ Wizard or some other measurement program, or whether it's what you're getting with your room correction program, but you're taking some measurements in the room at, you know, something close to seating locations, and we see what that graph is. And then we have to decide on some kind of target curve. One way or another, we have to decide for ourselves some kind of target curve that the equalization is going to take what it measured and try and turn it into what we're trying to target, right? And yep. if we say what I'm trying to target is back to that completely original flat line, because we know that that's what the signal was, and we know that that's what the speaker minus reflections on axis was producing, then there's some logic in saying, well, isn't that what should reach the listening position, because that would be completely faithful to the original signal, and what we've done is true room elimination. we've taken the reflections of the room away. And but experience wise, almost any of us would say, well, we don't particularly enjoy, going back to Harman's whole, we do base our evaluations on listener preference. We don't particularly enjoy listening to speakers in an anechoic chamber. Everyone who's ever stepped, sure, no, but I mean, everyone who's ever stepped foot into an anechoic chamber will say, it sounds weird in here. Like, this doesn't sound like normal, regular life. An anechoic chamber is a very unusual environment.
Right. And I've had, let me throw this scenario at you. And I've had this yeah. debate with, audiophiles.
Yeah.
Two channel systems rely on the room. Okay. I've experienced a two channel system. Tom and I talked about this. Tom has experienced it too. Uh-huh. I've experienced a two channel system that sounded like Atmos, because it's, okay. you're perfectly centered. You're sitting in the perfect spot, yeah. and the sounds are bouncing around the room to give you the feeling that sounds are coming from overhead. There was a walk around the room and it was two channels. It's totally yeah. possible because it's based off of the reflections. It's the technology they know how to bounce. Well, we can
do it in headphones too, right?
Correct. Like all right.
Do it through head-related transfer function.
Yep. In home theater, you have speakers everywhere. So you have you're surrounded by speakers. If you set up an anechoic chamber in your theater, like if you get as close as possible.
If your theater were an anechoic chamber. Okay.
Right. When you walked in, you'd be like, this sounds weird. Yeah. But when you threw on, say, and I don't know why this comes to mind, but Hunt for Red October, and you're mm-hmm. watching the scene when he walks into Greer's office, right? Mm-hmm. And it's an office. And mm-hmm. there are office sounds. Mm-hmm. In that anechoic chamber, you are now transported because all of your speakers are giving you an office environment. Sure. You're not in an anechoic chamber anymore. You are now in that office. Because the speakers are providing you exactly what's going on. And that's why
they're giving you the environmental cues.
Exactly. So like if a mosquito was going to go, ming, you would hear it because you're not being inhibited by anything else in the world. Right. So where people, I find it funny that a lot of people are like, oh, you need diffusers. No, you need absorption.
should start there. Yes.
In a home theater now where everything is discreet. Mm. You should be able to achieve, you want that to be as discreet as possible. You only want to hear the speakers. You don't want reflections, especially in an Atmos setup.
So here's the interesting thing. Here's where my thinking has evolved on where I'm going to try and adjust my personal target curve to. And it's sort of like, it's borrowing a little bit of sort of traditional audiophile thinking, but then putting my own spin onto it, which is, I think one of the problems in the whole debate about people trying to decide whether there even should be a reference standardized target curve or what their own personal one should be, one of the difficulties in that is we tend to be listening to either music recordings or movie recordings where we don't actually know what it sounded like when it was recorded. You know, it was done Yeah, no, it was done at either some other venue or it was completely generated, you know, because many sound effects were never recorded with a microphone. They were generated inside a computer. So we don't actually know what it sounded like. So we're trying to make an evaluation of, well, have I tuned my system to be accurate to what it was supposed to sound like without the experience of ever knowing what it originally sounded like, which is a kind of a difficult thing to target. And then people make the logical next step, which is to say, well, somebody heard it when they made this recording. The recording engineers heard it. So doesn't it make sense that what we're trying to get at home is whatever sounds like what the recording engineer heard. They heard something. They were satisfied with what they heard enough that they said, this is finalized and this is what's going on the disc, or this is what's, you know, going in the saved file. And therefore, shouldn't we be trying to replicate that? Like if we're going for creator's intent, accuracy to the recording, then that's a logical place to be of like, okay, I'm going to try and get to whatever the final recording engineer who pressed save on the file, that's what they heard. Of course, we all know the problem is there. Different recording studios have slightly different sounds. There is no universal reference target curve for all of us to get to in our own systems. And so we end up back at the same problem, right? It's there's too many variables. We don't actually know. So my evolution of the thinking has been, wait a second. Let's take a real life piano, let's say. Choose any instrument you want, but I want one that has a nice wide frequency range. So most people are familiar with a piano. It's got a pretty nice wide frequency range. Let's take an actual piano. Let's put it in any room. Anechoic chamber, completely reflective room, wide open room, closed room, whatever. Put it in any room, and we go ahead and we play that piano. And we record that piano while it's playing, and then we play back the recording. Same room, right? All done the same time, all in the same room. The audiophile logic has always been, what makes sense to me is that whatever room I'm in, whether it's acoustically treated or not, it should sound like I brought a real life instrument into my room. And I agree with that when it's that type of recording, right? When it's a recording that was done, studio conditions, close mic'd, the recording contains essentially no reflections of its own, no sense of space. You play back that type of recording in whatever room you're in, and it should sound as though that instrument or that voice has been brought into your room. Right.
You just touched on something that I'm not sure you're realizing, but it's like,
okay,
you just said the recording should have no sense of space.
Well, I'm saying that the reason I haven't always agreed with the audiophile, the traditional audiophile argument for why room treatments aren't necessary, right? Because that's been a thing, or why the ideal is that, you know, every speaker is completely full range. The argument there has always come back to, my sound system should sound as though I brought the instruments and voices into my room.
Right.
And my argument against that has been, but there are concert recordings. And the concert recordings live, they do include a sense of space. Mm-hmm. So if I don't want to bring a stadium into my little room, that doesn't make any sense to me. If I'm listening to a concert recording, I want the sensation that I, the listener, have been teleported to that stadium.
Right.
And I'm not in my little room anymore. So that's why I've argued against the audiophile approach of, don't bother treating the room because the goal is to bring the instruments into the room. I'm like, that only works for certain types of recordings. I'm actually in agreement when it comes to those specific types of recordings, but not all recordings are that type of recording. So what I come back to though is, what if we do evaluate on, I have the actual instrument here in my room, and without moving anything, I record that instrument in this room and then I play it back through speakers in that same room. I haven't moved. Nothing has moved. We do that scenario. I think logically, this is where my evolution of thinking has come to.
Part of the instrument though.
Well, yes, but what I'm saying is the ideal in that scenario is, when I play back that scenario through these speakers, I shouldn't be able to tell with my eyes closed the real instrument apart from what came out of the speakers. Because why in that scenario should anything sound different? The recording should sound exactly like the real life instrument, right? That becomes the target curve, because if I am EQing my system, if I experimentally EQ my system.
Oh, for that room.
For that room, okay. For that scenario, for those speakers in that room, that is reproducing something that made a sound in that room, right? To me, it doesn't make sense that if you brought a real life instrument or someone is just speaking in a real life room, you record them in that room and then play it back through speakers in that room, that the speakers sound different than the original. Those things should match. That's giving us a real life, real time frame of reference and comparison, not to something where I don't know what was recorded or how it sounded. I know how it sounded because I was here when the sound was made and now it's being played back to me and it should sound the same.
Yeah.
And I mean, experimentally, right? Harman has done things similar to this. Revel has done things similar to this as a demonstration to be like, here's our speakers playing back what you just heard in this very room and notice how amazingly similar those things sound. They've done that demonstration.
So,
and we don't end up with speakers that perform any differently in an anechoic chamber. They are still flat speakers. Mm-hmm. That's that we've come back to that. Experimentally, that has been shown. It's that if all of that is accurate, and this kind of ends up being Floyd Toole's argument, right? Is that if that's what you do, then you aren't equalizing your target curve for the microphone that's been put at your listening position. You're not equalizing for like anything other than the natural response that reaches that microphone from really, really accurate speakers. Right. Like if you have really, really accurate speakers as confirmed in an anechoic chamber, the sound that ends up reaching your listening position, even though at that microphone position is no longer a flat line like it was in the anechoic chamber, it is the correct response. Like you didn't have to target anything. You didn't have to apply any EQ at all. It got there the way it was supposed to be. That's, you know, it's simple.
Well, yeah, but you could, it's all of that is like, so like you said, you're going to bring up, why don't you just, instead of bringing a piano into that room, just for everybody, here's where we get a standard. You bring a piano into an anechoic chamber, record it.
Yes.
And everything should be flat across the board.
Yeah, it should be exactly what came out of the piano right there. Correct. Is exactly what's there. Yeah, yes, yes, yes.
So then all you got to do is tune your room to everything being flat. And you've just duplicated the anechoic chamber. And now every sound that comes through would be flat. And that's natural because what you're going for is in real life. If you and I are talking in a room, your voice is going to sound different than if we talked outside, right?
Yeah. Like if I'm in a tile bathroom versus a living room,
exactly.
It's still me. My voice didn't change, but it sounds different. Yes.
Instead of bringing instruments or things into a room and then duplicating that room in that room, just bring the instruments into an anechoic chamber. And now, which is what we're trying to do. The goal, right? Even today, the goal is
when you
play everything flat and then you're getting exactly what's real life.
That's the thing. In the anechoic chamber with the sweep tone, the generated sweep tone and everything.
Now you're doing a sweep tone though. What? I'm sorry about the instrument though.
But this is the same logical argument, right? That's flat. We know it's flat. We know it measures flat in the anechoic chamber. If we then measure at the microphone position, it becomes necessary to equalize it to also be flat.
Well, that's what would happen. Like if you heard a piano in an anechoic chamber or in a field, you hear a C note, it's going to go bing and go right over whatever.
What I'm saying is,
I'm not
trying to replicate. I'm not trying to replicate what that piano sounds like in the anechoic chamber.
Oh, yeah, you are.
I'm trying to replicate. This is the argument. I'm saying I'm trying to replicate that piano.
Right.
I'm trying to replicate that piano,
correct,
not the piano in an anechoic chamber.
Mm-mm. You're trying to replicate.
Unless my room is also an anechoic chamber.
No. That's, yes. Rob, You're trying to replicate a piano in an anechoic chamber so that everything outside, anything recorded outside an anechoic chamber will now have that environment in that recording. And now your room will be duplicating that. And especially in a home theater, that's exactly what we want. You don't want to invite any variables. That's what the point of an anechoic chamber is. It takes all the variables out of the chain. So now your room, it's going to be hard. I mean, to make your room an anechoic chamber is almost impossible.
Well, you have to make it an anechoic chamber.
Correct. So it's going to be almost impossible. But our goal is to try and get there, because now as close as we can to get there. And that's what Trinov's trying to do with their waveforming. And because what they're doing is they're trying to eliminate those reflections in a way that's going to be, hopefully 20 years from now, it'll be in the Denons and it'll be something that's like, it's literally like, we're going to set up speakers all around us. I know Tom hates this, but they're literally going to be there to cancel the sounds, noise canceling around us. Sure. You're not even going to need room treatments, but it's going to be like hearing.
It is a room treatment. It's just active room.
It's
treatment.
An active that's room. What it is. It's a digital room treatment, right? Yeah. So, but that's the point. So like, I know you don't want to hear a piano played in an anechoic chamber, but your flat line, your reference level should be that. And then when you get a recording, now if you can get that in your room, if you're in your room and you're like, wow, it sounds like a piano in an anechoic chamber, that stinks. But now when you hear a symphony played in a symphony, you're going to hear everything. You're going to hear the room. It's going to bring that recording in as accurate as the piano in the anechoic chamber.
So what's interesting there is now we've ended up on the polar opposite side of the audiophile argument, which is that if our rooms are tuned that way, they're tuned to, for all intents and purposes, replicate as closely as possible an anechoic chamber. Now, the only types of recordings that are going to sound pleasing to us in this system are recordings that include in the recording a sense of environment. Because otherwise, if it's a close mic, no reflection recording, like a studio vocal booth type of recording, now it's going to sound like an anechoic chamber, which most people would argue is not a pleasing listening environment. So we've flipped it from the audiophile argument of, I don't care about treating my room because I only care about recordings that have no sense of space in the recording. So now it's as if I brought that instrument into my room, whatever my room might be. It's like I brought that saxophonist here to play a private concert for me. And maybe it's weird and echoey, but if he was here in real life, it would be weird and echoey. And that's what I'm getting from this recording. Or it's only going to work because my room now sounds like an anechoic chamber. Now everything's going to, if the recording doesn't have a sense of space included inside of it, it's going to be like listening in an anechoic chamber. So ultimately we end up at, are we confining ourselves to saying there's only one pleasing type of recording that I can listen to?
Not at all.
Yeah. Well, see that's where my current thinking has changed on it, because I'm like, look, I'm going to be listening to both types of recordings. Even if somehow today somebody out there, a god, put his finger down and decreed this is now the one type of recording that everyone's going to make from this date onward, we still have all the previous recordings that exist, and some of them are studio close mic recordings, and some of them are a live recording and contain a sense of environment, and I'm still going to want to play those back. What makes sense to me is because we have this absence of some kind of completely universal reference standard target curve that I'm aiming for, if I just aim for completely flat, the way that it would measure in an anechoic chamber, there are going to be recordings that just sound not right, because the person who pressed save on the file, that's not how they heard it. For sure, that's not how they heard it.
No, because they're in a room. They're not.
That's right. And then when I play it back in my room, it sounds like an anechoic chamber. It sounds strange. And it's very clearly not what was intended. So if what I have instead is I've achieved a system where if I brought some real life instrument in here and I recorded at the same time and I played it back in this room and it sounds completely real to me, then what I'm getting from my sound system at my listening position is a believable, realistic representation of the types of recordings where, yeah, there's no environment. And then if I do bring the type of recording that does have an environment, it's going to be a reflection of if somebody had made that recording in this room, like if I'm in a mixing studio, if I'm in a mastering stage, it's got some kind of room curve going on. It might not be literally exactly the same as mine, but it's the same as if they had used their system in this room, this is what they would have heard. Right. So it's like, it's still a compromise. I'm completely saying, like, because there's an absence of a universal standard, we've got to end up compromising somewhere.
Well, you don't. It's, well, it's like Rob.
You create a limitless number of target curves, I guess.
No, you got chocolate and vanilla ice cream. Mm-hmm. There's no standard. You don't have to like either of them. You don't have to get if you got chocolate and vanilla, you don't have to get the one that's mixed together.
Yeah.
Basically, what you just described it's home theater and audiophiles. Audiophiles want to use the room. You want to hear these recordings, those studio recordings where, yes, the mic is like within an inch of the instrument. Yeah. Because
the whole room's padded and everything. It's pretty close to anechoic.
They're trying to get an anechoic recording so that when you listen in a room, the room is part of your particular room, like you said.
It's this like is you like brought they're that, here that playing performer into in my room. That's right.
Right?
That's right. Yeah.
There's nothing wrong. That's like having them there in your room.
That's right. That's my what own you're private going concert. For. Yes.
Yeah. But if you want a room that can duplicate an environment, that's a different room.
That's right.
You don't need a new standard. You just have to have the wherewithal. You have to have the knowledge to know, I need a different room. The problem is people online are telling you one's wrong over the other.
That's
home theater exactly, people aren't telling audiophiles, you've got to get this. But audiophiles like, you don't need all that. Well, I do for what I want. And it's, you know, so neither one is wrong, and in a lot of these cases, it's all opinion. So,
but I do think we end up at having to accept some kind of compromise because, realistically speaking, even a well-appointed, expensive home theater, it is still not anechoic.
No,
like the room is going to be there. There's gonna be something in the room. What all I'm trying to get at is. I think the simple answer is, I mean, I guess you're explaining why there's some level of disagreement that you have, but it's like, to me, it only makes sense that what we're after is some kind of realism. Like whether that is
wholly, you're going after real life.
Yeah.
That's all you're going for.
Yeah. Either that is some kind of wholly fictionalized, created for you realism in a fantasy movie that doesn't exist in any real environment on Earth, or we are trying to recreate a real live performance, whether that's, you know, brought right into my room or not. It's like to get yourself to that, like what I'm trying to get away from is the online argument conversation about whether it's based on Harman's research or it's based on Odyssey's research or Trinov's or whomever's it might be, that there is sort of this target curve that we should all be going for, that we're somehow going to work our way to a standardized target curve that we should all be aiming for. Let's say we all slavishly follow that. We hypothetical, we go ahead, we all slavishly follow that. And then I play back that system in the scenario that I gave you of I did bring a real life piano and I recorded and played it through my speakers. And I can tell a difference between those two things. Something is wrong. Something has gone wrong in my mind. If experimentally we all slavishly follow some kind of universal target curve only to discover that if I do the experiment of the real life thing was in my real room and then I play it back and those two things don't sound the same, we got something wrong. That's what I'm driving at. I'm saying that maybe it's flawed logic, but I'm saying that if we get that part right, we get that side of it right, where the recording and the real life event both done in the same room at the same time. If those two things sound the same, then how can that be wrong? I guess is the simple way of how can I be wrong in having that be whatever I measure now, whatever I take my U-Mic 1 and I measure in room EQ, because that's not going to be a flat line. It's not going to be a perfectly flat line.
So
it's going to be something other than a perfectly flat line. How can that be wrong?
I'll tell you why.
Okay.
You're recording in your room.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So you're recording your room.
Well, let me explain. I have to put a caveat on it because in the scenario that I gave, I simplified very, very much saying like, okay, I have this real life instrument, I record and I play it back through the speakers. The type of recording and where the microphones are placed and where the speakers are playing it back from, that has to be super, super carefully done, right? Because like, if I just say, okay, I brought a piano into my room, I put a microphone on my back wall and I recorded it there, and then I play it through two speakers in the upper corners of the front of the room, like, of course that's going to sound different, right? So I'm getting at, you have to have the scenario where what comes into the microphones is what inverse comes out of the speakers. So it has to be a very carefully set up recording in this room.
You can be as careful as you want, right?
Yeah.
So it's going to be wrong on the second playback. Invariably, it's going to be wrong to your perception, because one, unless you set up, like, if you put microphones next to your ears.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's say we're going crazy here to get as accurate as possible.
Well, this is the binaural thing, right?
No.
This is binaural.
So you put two microphones next to your ears.
Yeah.
You play the piano in that room. Now, how do you set your speakers up for the playback?
Yeah.
Okay.
They'd have to be right by your ears. Yeah.
Well, they'd have to be right by your ears. But now, if they're right by your ears, like headphones, you're not in that room. So how do I get it now? If I'm going to use conventional speakers, this is why everything has to be based off an anechoic chamber. Your scenario, those perfectly matched speakers that are playing perfect are going to be playing back your room to you. So your room is going to be playing back your room. So you're going to
exactly
get
right,
double the room experience.
Okay.
Kind of like a mirror into a mirror, mirror, mirror. And it's just going to keep going. So you're going to have an audible difference. That's why you go baseline in an anechoic chamber and then try to go flat in your room. You don't want to be an anechoic, but now that's when you get accuracy. It's almost I would say it's impossible to get accuracy by playing an instrument and then hearing it back in the room, because you're also hearing back the room.
You're exactly right. So now we get to the final stage of it. All right. The final stage is we're bringing the real life piano into my room and I listen to it play.
Why did you just play a guitar? It's just sitting on your lap. Why are you bringing a giant piano?
Okay. We bring a real life instrument that has a nice wide frequency range. We bring that into our room. We listen to it play. Now, forget about recording that while it's happening right now in this room. What we have a magical hypothetical scenario where
we're bringing magic in.
Well, actually, you know what? It doesn't have to be. Let's say it's all electronically generated, so that the playback can literally be identical regardless of the time or place. So let's bring let's say it's an electronically generated sound, so that we play that electronically generated sound in our room. I listen to it, and then I play what is a recording of that same electronically generated sound through speakers.
Yep.
Not a recording of what was just played, but just like a previously existing recording done some way. And now the idea is, okay, whether that one that was just generated in my room right now in front of me, or the recording coming through my speakers, those two things should be exactly the same. Like, my speakers are reproducing the live event, right?
But what
like,
was what the I'm trying to, but Rob, you just started with like, okay, now it's on an instrument, it's something playing digitally, which would
well,
be
I'm just
speaker.
Saying otherwise
you're,
otherwise
you're
it
comparing
has to,
two speakers at that point.
Well, I know. Well, this is the problem, right? Because otherwise it has to be
Rob, you're trying not to go to an anechoic chamber. for a flat line.
No, no. Here's the simplified thing I'm getting at. The problem that I am seeing in the debate online with this trying to come to some kind of slavishly followed universal target curve where mine is right and yours is wrong. The problem there is that it should all come back to a real life instrument should still sound like a real life instrument. Because right. if it doesn't, then something somewhere has gone wrong. That if I am recreating that same sound in my room and it doesn't sound the same anymore, something went wrong somewhere in the chain that
it's
went wrong.
The room.
No. But because
Rob, we've all been to live events and you go, wow, the acoustics here are horrible.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So why are we taking that variable out? What an instrument played in an acoustic, in an anechoic chamber. That's what it sounds like.
The instrument all by itself. Sure.
Correct. Yeah. Anything deviating from that.
Yeah.
Is the room. You're not hearing the instrument anymore. Okay. You're hearing the room it was played in.
So we record the instrument in the anechoic chamber. That's the recording we have. That's what's going to get played back through my speakers in my room. Okay, that's fine. Good. Okay, we're on there. And now we also play the real life instrument in the room. And this is why I was saying, okay, it's kind of got to be a little bit of magic because it's got to be the absolute world's most accurate, best real life performer who can literally do exactly what they did in the anechoic chamber again in my room. So let's just imagine we have that performer.
Should be duplicate.
That should be duplicate. That's what I'm getting at.
That's what I said.
I'm getting at that.
20 minutes ago.
But here's the thing. When that anechoic recording gets played and I measure the response at the microphone in my seat.
Yeah.
That is not the flat line that would have been recorded in the anechoic chamber. Because the room has now impacted.
Yeah, but you've tuned the room to go flat. That's the goal.
We've added the room on top of the anechoic recording.
No. Tuned the room. Original question was like, what's my target curve of my room? And I'm trying to go flat.
Right.
So if you're trying, if you made that recording playing flat, then what's the problem?
Because unless you have passively made the room. Unless you have passively made the room anechoic, when we're talking about using any type of room correction program or EQ, that's an electronic changing, right? Yeah. We're changing the signal before it comes out of the speakers.
Yeah.
In order to try and counteract what the room is then going to do to it, right?
Okay.
So we all agree. If your listening room were an anechoic chamber, then of course you could record something in an anechoic chamber, then play it back in your room, and it would sound exactly the same in both environments, because the environments are the same.
Correct.
We all know that even if you've got a well-padded home theater, it's not literally an anechoic chamber. So what was recorded in the anechoic chamber, minus any equalization, just the passive room, measures different in the room than it does in the anechoic chamber. So then the logic goes, okay, so we apply some kind of electronic equalization to get the room to now measure like the anechoic chamber again.
Correct.
Right? Those two things should be equal.
Yep.
But I'm saying if we bring the real life instrument into the room has been passively treated, but it is not
an anechoic
chamber. That instrument doesn't sound the same as it did in the anechoic chamber.
Yeah, right? It would.
The real life instrument doesn't sound the same as the anechoic chamber.
But you've treated
in the anechoic chamber.
If you've treated the room,
only if you've treated the room to be an anechoic chamber. I'm saying even in our treated absorption rooms, they're not an anechoic chamber.
If you were able to play that instrument, so say we'll bring a piano. I know you love that.
World's
giant
most
instrument.
Consistent pianist. Yeah, world's most consistent pianist.
He
plays exactly the same in the anechoic
chamber
and the real room.
Right?
Yes. And I hear it in the anechoic chamber. I record it.
Correct.
Yes.
You recorded that. You bring that into your room.
Yes.
Right?
That recording or that same pianist?
The recording and the pianist come into your room.
Okay, we're bringing them both. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. So you play back the recording in your room.
Yeah.
Now, okay. is your playback system tuned to flat? Yes. So it should be playing everything flat. What's recorded is what you're getting. And that's you're going to hear. You've got room treatment.
What comes out of the speakers, like right at the face of the speaker, right?
Yep.
What comes out of the speaker? Yes. Flat. Yes.
Okay.
Right. That would be the only way to recreate what was recorded in the anechoic chamber. What comes out of the face of the speaker? Yes. Flat.
Right.
But by the time it reaches your listening position,
it will have bounced around the room.
It will not be flat anymore. That's the issue. In the anechoic chamber, right? If I set up a listening seat in the anechoic chamber, right?
Okay.
Then what came out of the face of the speaker is the same as what reached my listening position in the anechoic chamber, because there's no impact of the room.
No. You're not in there. I mean, you're not in there. You've got microphone in there, right? You've got in there playing that sound, right?
Yeah. And you record it in the anechoic chamber. Yes. Correct.
So you've got that recording and then you bring that recording to your room and you play it and listen to it.
Yeah.
Then you play that sound through, you play the recording. All right. The piano plays in your room. Okay, that's what that sounds like in my
room.
The
real life person, yes.
Correct. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Now, that recording, that flatlined recording plays in your room. It's going to sound exactly the same.
Okay, but then why are we putting any room correction EQ on that signal? That's the argument.
Because we want to take the room out of it. I already said that. I don't want the room messing with my multiple, I got 11 channels going. I don't need the room to play.
But the
No, Rob, that's what we said this earlier, and I just said it. I can have chocolate and vanilla. I can have a room that I want the room to affect the environment.
Okay.
Or I can have a room.
I'm saying the room is going to infect it, is going to affect it, right? Unless we build an anechoic chamber as a listening room.
Correct.
So we've got the real life piano in the anechoic chamber.
Right.
Right. I listen to that piano in the anechoic chamber. I record that piano in the anechoic chamber. All right.
Right.
Now, the great thing about the anechoic chamber is no matter where I put the microphone in that anechoic chamber, no matter where my listening position is, whether the microphone was right up to the face of the speaker or it's back at my seat or it's anywhere else in the anechoic chamber, same sound. Same sound gets recorded. Like, we're talking on axis. We're aiming the speaker at the microphone in every scenario. But, like, you know, same sound no matter where it was. I transport all of that, the real-life musician, into a real-life room. The real-life room is not an anechoic chamber. Like, as much as we might try to get it kind of close to it, it's not an anechoic chamber. We do all that again. Now, that anechoic recording, I'm saying to you, does not sound like the anechoic chamber anymore at my seat. It sounds like, it sounds like whatever my room has done to it. So if we said, okay, great, perfect. We've recreated the same instrument via a recording in the room, right? We took the real life musician, heard it in an anechoic chamber, doesn't sound the same as it sounds in my real room, right? We agree on that, right? If I was listening to the musician in an anechoic chamber,
you don't want
and then
that.
I listen to that.
Like you said, it's like nobody wants to hear that.
So then the argument is, why are we applying any equalization at all? Because we didn't equalize the real life musician. That's the whole thing. We didn't equalize the real life musician. He or she played the same sound in the anechoic chamber as they did in, is the world's most consistent musician. But they played exactly the same thing.
You're asking a question that we've already answered, though. You're saying, like, why would we do that? Well, I want to get as close to an anechoic chamber as possible because I want to be, I don't want to hear, Harrison Ford and James Earl Jones in an office in my theater. I want to be transported to the office that they're in.
I know.
So audibly, I need to take my room effects out. So then I am transported there. Just like a piano playing on a stage. A piano playing on a stage in a concert hall. You want to be transported to the concert hall. Right. You don't want that piano in your room. So you would have as close to an anechoic chamber as you could possibly get for that scenario. Mm-hmm. Now, if you want that piano playing in your room, don't put up room treatments. Because now it'll be like that piano is in your room. It's the reason we go to flat, or we try in home theater to get to flat, is because we're trying to get those environments in our room. Audiophiles, this argument is silly because you're chocolate and vanilla here. Audiophiles want the room to work for them. They want that environment. We're talking about environments. Home theater, you're trying to eliminate it. Audiophiles are using it.
Yeah. No, there's one thing that is missing. This is the only area where you and I are disagreeing. There's the one element that's missing, which is that if the room all by itself, no electronic equalization, if the room all by itself were essentially anechoic chamber, then we have what you're talking about, right? So, I mean, studio recordings, the close mic recordings, the vocal booth recordings, they're going to sound a little weird because they're
going to sound like you're in an old anechoic chamber.
Yeah, they're going to sound like you're in an anechoic chamber. Not they're going to preferred. Sound like you're in that vocal booth. Okay, correct. But it is what it is. That's fine. What I'm getting at is if you try to use an electronic equalization to remove, so we have a room, it isn't an anechoic chamber. We're going to try and do something to the signal before it comes out of the speakers to counteract what the room is going to do to that sound after it comes out of the speakers. Yeah. That's all equalization can do. All it can do is change the sound that before it came out of the speakers, and we're trying to like preemptively change it so that now it does come out of the speakers. We know the room is going to impact it, but those two things cancel each other out. The changes we made beforehand cancel out the
changes. Because it's all based off of the room, right? Odyssey EQ is all based off of the room. So it's only going to cancel stuff out that it has to.
I'm saying that's the problem, right? I'm saying that's the issue is that I don't think we can do electronically what you're talking about. I don't think we can get an equalization target curve that mimics an anechoic chamber.
Because it should be flat.
Well, I mean, it would be a curve because we're counteracting the impact that the room has on the sound after it came out of the speaker, which is a curve. So we're like trying to put an inverse curve before it comes out of the speaker so that then it goes into the room.
Your audio that you're hearing should be flat. The curve is put in because you're talking about like we're getting to that curve again where you have a curve like
right.
You can set certain things because, and all that curve is doing is, like I said earlier, you're rolling off a curve. If you're flat all the way, when you're out in a field and you yell at somebody or you clap hands, it's flat.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
No. Let's simplify this further, right? If
those curves are called room curves.
Yeah, no. If you're in your actual theater, and at your seat, you have now used your room correction, your equalization system, so that flat signal results in flat measurement at the seat, just like it would in an anechoic chamber. Because that's kind of your argument, right? You're saying that anechoic chamber signal played flat, measures flat in the anechoic chamber. I'm going to replicate that in my room.
Right.
At my seat, plays flat, right? So we take the recording of the real life instrument that was made in the anechoic chamber. We play it through that scenario. It sounds like that instrument is in an anechoic chamber.
Right.
Right? Because we've done flat in, flat out at the seat, both in the anechoic chamber and in your room.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, we've replicated what was recorded in the anechoic chamber. That's what it sounds like in my room now. And this is where I'm saying, now you teleport the real life instrument into your room.
It's going to sound like it's in an anechoic chamber.
No, the real life instrument isn't going to sound like it's in an anechoic chamber in your real life room.
Because if you've done it digitally, if you've done it digitally, it wouldn't. But if you did it with room
that's exactly what I'm getting at. That's exactly what I'm getting at. Because what I'm saying is, in this whole attempt to use an equalization system, right? Use a room correction system.
Yeah.
To get us back to the anechoic response.
Correct.
You know, if that's what we're targeting, that's what we're aiming for. Microphone measures flat in, flat out.
Right.
If that's what we've done, then something has, I'm arguing, something has gone awry, because now
not
if you take the real life.
Not awry. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Not awry. Rob, it's not awry. Here's the thing.
The real life instrument sounds like it's in an anechoic chamber now.
Because your room. Just like I said earlier, we've all been to live events.
No, wait a minute.
Let me finish. We've all been to live events where you're like, the acoustics in here are horrible. That would include playing a piano in an anechoic chamber. You'd be like, why would I bring a piano into my home theater that is set up to bring environments into me? So, like I said a half hour ago, we're talking about two different rooms. But you want a single room to do both things. You can't have
that. Yes, that's exactly it.
Well,
yes.
Actually, you can have it. And that's what Trinov and Storm are working on.
Mm.
If you want that environment, you don't do room treatments. You set, okay, I want everything canceled out. I want to sound like an anechoic chamber in here. And I would bet 10-20 years, maybe sooner, there'll be a little button on the front of a Trinov, and you could turn your room into an anechoic chamber, because we already have it for headphones. We have noise canceling, right? So like literally nothing is playing in your living room.
Okay.
And it's dead. You're like, you even speak and you go, nothing.
Okay. Because
it canceled it, right?
Okay.
That's a setting. Oh, okay. I want that piano in my room. Let's go pure. That's a setting. So it's,
or it's just what comes out of the speakers is exactly, flat.
Pure.
Yeah. But then we allow the room. Well, no,
to,
I mean,
you allow, yeah, we the, allow room the room to make a change the sound. To that sound. And I mean, and if you're going to go that, if you can go from one extreme to the other, you can tune to taste in the middle. That's what all this technology is about. But at the end of it, what is our target? Our baseline should be flat. Because anything other than that, you're deviating from reality, which is what everything is based off of. Reality is the anechoic chamber. You don't want to duplicate that, but that a reality of sound is what you hear in an anechoic chamber. Anything off of that is you're deviating from reality. Okay? So there's your standard. There's your reference.
If that's the recording.
Your reference. Well, no. Any sound. All a sound is a vibration, right? It doesn't matter what it is. If it was a piano, a gunshot, a guitar, a drum snare, whatever.
So it's recreated all anechoically.
Right.
You
tune to anechoic, and now all of your sounds after that are duplicated to what the reality was in that. So like if you play a guitar in an open
room
field,
reflections.
That's what it's going to sound like. If you played a guitar in a closet, that's what it's going to sound like.
Okay.
But if you want it to sound like it's playing in your room, you turn that off and you allow that pure anechoic guitar sound to play in your room and allow the
So
do you see what I mean?
Everything goes back to the anechoic sound. Yeah, where we arrived and where I agree is that honestly the only way that we're gonna get to the scenario that you're talking about is what you're exactly like you're saying, like Trinov and what Storm are trying to advance. Because what I'm getting is it would require active room treatment like you're talking about.
Yeah.
Something with the actual capability to, through electronic means, replicate an actual anechoic environment. Because the thing is, with the more generalized systems that we have right now, if I passively treat my room, right, I put up some bass traps and I put up some absorption panels, and then I run the type of normal equalization that we have today, I can't actually replicate electronically the anechoic environment, right?
Not electronically, but you can get real close using both, right?
Flat in at my seat is pretty darn close to flat out, but I can't 100%, like I say, if you then brought the actual instrument into that room, the actual instrument wouldn't sound exactly the same as it did in the anechoic chamber, right? Because without the electronic part of that equation, we can't actually replicate.
Well, you could. The anechoic chamber. You just have to remove all your room treatments.
Well, you'd have to. You'd have to have an anechoic chamber
for
to
people.
Replicate.
Like, and I've talked to people at Trinov when I was at CD. Mm-hmm. I've talked to people since, and it's like you don't need their waveforming system. Okay. Even they say that they're like,
yeah,
a good amount of room treatments will do the same thing. Mm-hmm. Or to your. No, yeah, they know you're trying to cancel. If you treat your room appropriately, you can get damn close to that. So in your scenario, we don't necessarily need to get to, like, you don't need the money to get to a Trinov or something someday to get that active cancellation.
Yeah.
You could just do two rooms. You have a listening room, which right. many of our listeners do. You know, they'll yes. have multiple rooms.
Yeah, it's back to the music room versus movie room. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. So,
but that one utilizes the room. The other is you're trying to get as close to an anechoic chamber as possible. You set up enough room treatments, mm-hmm. you run room correction, and mm-hmm. you're getting closer to that. I mean, we've both said, I know you guys have been saying it for years, the more room yeah. treatments you have, the less
room your room correction
is working. Yeah. But it yeah. actually is still working because it's now allowing you to hear the frequencies. The more treatments you have, mm-hmm. the room correction can be more correct.
Yeah.
The less room correction you have, the less treatments you have,
yeah.
room correction has to eliminate a lot of stuff. Your roll has to be steeper. A lot mm-hmm. of things have to change for you to get an odd, like a pleasing sound
yeah.
in all frequencies, right?
But, so I guess all I'm ending up at for today, because for the moment, either the technology doesn't exist or it's way out of my price range to do right. the fully active, you know, treatment yeah. to be able to electronically recreate
an
anechoic chamber.
And it's still in its infancy too.
That's, yeah, yeah. So I mean, even with all the money, it's not really truly available
at that
performance. But, yeah. Oh yeah.
But, and it's getting better.
But point being, that for the time being, like, cause all of it comes back to the whole online debate about what should the target curve be, right? How should we be manually manipulating Dirac or Odyssey or Anthem, room correction, whatever it is? Because I have the ability to change that target curve, then supposedly I must. And you know, what should that be? Because like most people are saying, well, they aren't targeting a completely flat line at the seed. It's either some kind of gradual rise, like a nice little 10 or 12 dB rise, or some people, you know, they do have like a house curve, whatever it is. Why can't we reach a consensus? Why isn't it just a completely flat line in terms of electronic, you know, compensation? You know, bringing all of that back, what I'm saying is for the time being, I want a well acoustically treated room so that it is certainly not reflective. That's what I want, even for just, you know, close mic vocal booth recordings. I'm starting with that. It is not 100% anechoic. So I'm saying for the time being, the real life instrument, I want it to sound for that type of recording, for that nearly anechoic type of recording. I don't want it to sound like an anechoic chamber. I want it to right. sound like real life, right? So I'm saying that if I have a really accurate playback and I basically just sort of capture what that really accurate playback is, that's sort of like the natural target that I want to go for. That's going to sound like real life in my room. As it is, my real life room, not highly reflective, but not completely anechoic either.
Correct.
And so I personally end up with just this going back to what I did say on AV Rant, right? I get an anechoic recording. Or let me think about that. Yeah, no, I get an anechoic recording of just a real life instrument, just playing a series of chords.
Yep, yep.
Right? Playing a series of chords, from low to high. I play back through my system. I don't want that to sound in my listening room, my home theater room, like an actual anechoic chamber. I know that's what was recorded. was in the anechoic chamber, if I'm literally being completely accurate to just the recording itself and the environment of that recording, then right. that sounds like an anechoic chamber, right? Yeah, we agree on that. But what I want that recording to sound like, because this goes back to, I think the subjective intent wasn't for you to hear that like it was you're in an anechoic chamber. It was to bring that instrument into your room. I think that was sort of the intent. So I want that to sound like it would sound if I brought the real life instrument into my room and played that. Cause like, I'm not anything close to even, I don't even want to call myself an amateur musician, but I've dabbled in some instruments and I've played in some orchestras and my sister plays piano very, very well. And I'm familiar with, you know, how instruments sound in real life.
Yeah.
And I do want that anechoic recording that was minus any sense of room in the recording. When I play that back in my room, I want it to sound like a real life instrument in my room because it kind of should. It kind of should sound like a real life instrument in my room because the recording didn't have an environment in it, right? The recording is like bringing that instrument minus any room into my room. So Correct. Now I want it to sound like it's the instrument. It should Right. sound like it's the same instrument.
But I don't room. Understand the, so Yeah. you, for playing instruments.
Yeah.
That's what you want. But you said earlier, you were like, why don't we have a reference level for audio? And we actually do. It's
a reference target. Yeah.
Target. And we do. It's called, you do that, like you said, well, it was probably an hour ago now. You said, like, play a frequency sweep from 20 to 20K.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do that in an anechoic chamber.
Completely flat.
Yeah. Completely flat. That's what you want to do in your room. And then allow
I have the same thinking was where I was.
That's
before.
Exactly yeah. what you want to do. Right.
Yeah.
And then when an instrument is played in that room, it'll sound like the instrument is played in that room. Mm-hmm. That's the point.
Well, no, because I mean, like Harman has demonstrated, right? You get the speaker that in the anechoic chamber is completely flat, measures completely flat. Mm-hmm. That same speaker playing that same sweep measured in a real room at the actual
Not
seating
the
location
speaker.
isn't a flat line
the
anymore.
Instrument yeah. is playing. And I'm just saying instead of an instrument, you play a sweep in the room.
You
record
sweep.
A sweep in an anechoic yeah. chamber. And now yeah. that same sweep played in your room, you want that to play flat. Now when an instrument is played, you're going to get
there is a disconnect there because the speaker is producing it flat, just like it did in the anechoic chamber.
Correct.
But we know that when we measure that speaker in the real room,
that's what I just
it
said.
Doesn't measure flat. It doesn't measure flat it's, at the measurement
no,
position.
No, but you want it.
It measures what the speaker.
No,
did.
But you want the output to come out flat. Your room
yeah,
is
out of the speaker. Oh yeah. Out of the
that's
speaker.
That's what
flat.
I'm saying.
Out of the speaker.
So
flat,
you
yeah.
want it to come
but by
out.
By the time it reaches the seat, not flat anymore. Yeah.
It's not supposed to be. Because,
right. But that has to be your target curve. If you're measuring at the seat.
You have no room treatments, but the room should be set up.
It's like an issue.
No. But what I'm saying is, Rob, is like, you don't want your speaker. Now you're setting target curves so that you can get, you're saying you want your room to affect the sound, right?
In the same way that, yes, a real life sound played in that room. That an anechoic recording of that same original sound.
Right.
Those two things sound identical.
But here's the thing. You're trying to say, I want to hear exactly what was recorded. Right?
No. Not in this scenario. Not in an anechoic recording scenario.
Okay. Yeah. So you don't want, you want the room to affect it.
Yeah. What I want
so
is.
So you would have no target curve. Everything would be flat. You would set your system to flat, nothing.
You would end up with just no target curve whatsoever.
Exactly.
It would just be the accurate speaker playing in your room.
Rob, that's the point. That's what you want. That's exactly what you're going for. You go to pure and you turn all equalization off because you have a pure recording.
If it's an anechoic recording.
So is the target curve, as I stated a while ago, is a room curve. It's meant to adjust for the room because certain frequencies are being enhanced. And you want, when you set a curve, you're trying to duplicate the environment in your room. When you go flat, your room is the environment and you want that. That's what I'm, so I don't understand the debate or argument. It's very, very simple. Do you want your room to affect the sound? Run flat. Do you want to import, you want to take the room out of the equation? You need a curve, or you need room treatment. You know what I mean? You need to set a quote unquote curve.
Okay.
So you see what I mean? So there's really no argument. I want to run flat with room treatments. So that I'm getting everything
you're recreating environment reality. And
I'm thing. Recreating reality.
Like you're recreating what it sounded like in wherever it was recorded.
Which is the idea of a movie, right? You want to be on the street of New York. I want to be in the office of, you know, Admiral Greer. I want to be in a submarine. I don't want to hear sounds of a submarine in my room. I want to be in the submarine.
I've got to get going. So unfortunately we have to wrap it up, but okay. We've reached consensus. We're in agreement. The only last problem is the variable of, okay. People. So we had the, we have the anechoic recording. We're going to recreate that. Or not necessarily anechoic, right? We have the recording. The recording contains the principal thing that we're trying to listen to and the environment, whatever that environment might be. That environment might be anechoic, but it also might not be. And we recreate that exactly whatever it is in our room. Great. The only last issue is there was a step in between that recording and what you hear, and it's whatever the mastering and the other audio engineers did, right?
Yeah.
And so the issue there is whatever they were hearing in that middle step, right? In between recording and playback, there is somebody in between. There are often multiple somebodies in between there. And whatever they ultimately output is what they were satisfied with. This is what it should
artist
sound
intent.
Like.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
They tune to their taste, what they wanted you to hear.
So we end up back at the thing of they were not, I can guarantee you the recording engineers in between the recording and the playback, they were not doing it in an anechoic chamber. They had a room with some kind of acoustics, right? Now they might have done exactly what you're talking about, which is that they really, really treated the room. And then for the last bit that the treatments can't do, they apply electronic equalization so that they're hearing, you know, if it was recorded in an anechoic chamber, it sounds like anechoic chamber in their studio, whatever it is. And so if that's consistent in all three of those steps, great. Right? Now we have some kind of consistency from beginning of it to the end. But it is that step in the middle of not all studios, not all recording engineers, audio studios have been equalized and treated to sound like an anechoic chamber. If the recording was done in an anechoic chamber, they have a room curve in that middle step. And that's why the debate becomes, well, then we essentially have to know what the room curve was for every recording. If we want 100% accuracy to the final save file to recreate the recording studio at home.
Well, now you're getting, now you're arguing with yourself. So you said you want.
What I'm getting at is in reality, minus idealism.
No. In reality, we go to, this is why, and this is where the argument happens, where audiophiles will invariably argue against themselves because they're saying, but see, now they did something in the studio to alter it. So I want to sound like it's in the studio. Boom. Yeah. You want to duplicate the studio in your home? So you basically, Rob, just said you want to take your room out of it, which gets you back into, let's put this into a home theater and duplicate the studio environment as close, and you want your theater to be as close to an anechoic chamber as possible.
Let's just imagine the extreme scenario where the studio in between, in the middle, has a big old bass boost. Passively, right? Like you play any sound and it's just the room makes it louder, right?
Yeah.
So they, in the recording, turn down the bass, right? Because for it to sound right in their studio.
Rob, here's the thing. I know we're both pressed for time. You don't have to, basically what you're saying is this is where the audiophile will argue against themselves.
This is the circle of confusion that Dr. Floyd Toole talks about.
At all. You started off by saying, I want my room to sound like the instruments in it. But now the scenario you're saying, I want my room to sound like the studio. Well, now you have to go into a theater setup where you have room treatments and you'd be like, no, I want my room to do that. I can tell you how to get your room to do that.
We end up at the target being very difficult. Yeah.
It's not difficult. It's not at all. It's the mentality of going, I can do this here. No, you can't. You either need room treatments or active room, you know, digital room treatment or not. Do you want an instrument to sound like it's playing in your room? Yes. Okay. That's this setup. Do you want to sound like you're in the studio listening to them? Yes. That's this setup.
Okay.
Very simple. It's super simple. And that's what's funny about it is because they'll tell you, oh no, you should do that this way, but you can't. It won't happen because you're invariably, the room is going to affect the sound.
That's right.
And it won't sound like a studio. And what's funny is, like you said, you go into a studio, it's got padded walls, it's got all of this. And I'm like, I'm not doing that in my living room. Well, then it's not going to sound like a studio.
It won't.
But the purists will tell you, oh, you should run Pure. Yes, if you want it to sound like it's a piano is playing in your living room. And by the way, a piano playing in a living room with no room treatments is going to sound awful.
Yeah.
Just as awful as it would in an anechoic chamber. So,
but different.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Two ends of awful spectrum. But
yes. Yeah. Yeah.
But
yeah.
Yes. But you see what I mean? It's like there's really not an argument, and the people that are arguing are literally arguing against themselves. They're literally debating themselves. I want I don't want that. But you can have this if you get that.
Yes.
But no, you can't. Yes, you can.
It is It is trying to fit two polar opposite kinds of recording technique into a single playback system. Yeah.
And
like
you
with
can,
a single target.
Someday you can do, like, if Trinov gets their way and they develop this and storm the same thing, you'd be able to push a button and turn your room into an anechoic chamber. And then you can have exactly what you want. But it's, that's why I think it's that simple. It's not really a debate. It's just that audiophiles, we have years and years and decades, if not centuries of history of no room. You just listened in a room. And they think that that's what it should sound like, right? And to the point that if you went out in the middle of a field and played a guitar, it doesn't sound right to you for some reason because it's not in a room. You're used to the environment affecting it. So how do we get there today? Well, it's only been, 30 years of this development? And then you have this audiophile mentality, which is correct because you do want to – you want the room – if you want your room to sound like it's playing an instrument, that's what you would do, right? But now we have this new technology that changes the mindset a little bit. And there's some audiophiles that haven't come on board yet. They're just like, nope, don't need that. That's not reality.
let's leave it there. Yeah. We have to get to where the active room treatment can actually do
an anechoic chamber.
What we've been hoping to do. So it's the fully active treatment. We got to wait for that to develop and it will, and we can leave it there.
Or just set up a crap load of room treatments. That's great. But Rob, awesome. I mean, it's always fun. And I'll a little peek behind the curtain.
Okay.
Most of the time when Rob and I say goodbye, like we'll say goodbye right now and we'll literally say goodbye after we hang up here. But. Most of the time, it goes for another hours, Rob.
It could. It could. It won't today. We're
not
done.
Not today. I'm going to hang up here, see what my recordings look like. And if I still have to download, I'm still leaving, but I got to leave my computer open. But Rob, awesome as always. so much fun.
Now, just imagine we have all the YouTube comments to go after.
I can't wait.
So,
I think
I'm ignoring it. This is your podcast. I don't even have to look at them.
It won't be on YouTube. This is audio only. So we're just going to have. So that'll be for next take. It'll be next week's Takeover Tuesday. I'm sure you're going to get write-ins and be like, DJ was wrong or this was
there
wrong. You're
you
right,
go.
Rob. And this and that.
There
and
we
like,
go.
It's so much fun. So much fun. So, Rob, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, DJ. Always a pleasure.
Yep. Talk again soon. And everybody else, you know what you got to do.
Go push play.
What he said.
Hey Fred.
This has been a Hey Fred production with theme music by Jeff Bernhardt and Throne Vault Productions.